Welcome, everybody. My name is Sean Moisey. I'm the Executive Branch Manager of Education Care Regulation Support. And I'd like to commence our sector meeting today with acknowledgement of country. Dal Nuna, Dal Nunawal. Nyangul Nalawari, Dunimanya Nalawari, Dalawari, Ngata Dindi, Wangarali Jinyan. This is Nunawal country. Today we're gathering on Nunawal country. We always pay respect to elders, female and male. And I wish to recognise any other people and families with connection to the ACT and the lands of the ACT and region. And I wish to acknowledge their and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and the region. And I'd like to warmly welcome all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are with us today. On behalf of Children's Education, Care and Assurance Seeker, thanks for joining us for our first sector meeting of the year. It's really great to see everybody here today. I'd also like to extend a warm welcome to our guest speakers, Professor Sheila Digitati from Macquarie University, Lisa McCoy from ASIQA, Michael Pechich from In Safe Hands, and Amy Duncan from Reconciliation, the Ngarra Ngunnawalli team at Reconciliation Australia. Before I begin, just some housekeeping rules. You'll find the bathroom's just out the door at the back there. If we have an emergency, we have enough people to take you to the oval, which is also about at the back of the hall. So the team will guide you out if we have an emergency. Please feel free to stretch your legs, take a break, answer calls, get some refreshments in the foyer if you need to. We understand you're all really busy, and we appreciate the time you've taken to come and be with us this morning. Please note that the audio from today will be recorded and we'll also be taking photos. Let the team members know if you don't want your photo taken and they won't take your photo. The photos, podcast recordings and presentations from today will be shared via the Seeker communication channels. And hopefully you've noticed that as we do symposiums and sector meetings, we record them so that anyone can go back to them and have a look at them. In terms of today's agenda, I'll be giving an update or sort of wrapping up some of the things that are going on nationally. We'll also hear about the workforce pay and conditions research under the National Workforce Strategy. We'll also hear about the child safety review undertaken by ASIQA. And we'll hear about best practice for child safe environments from Michael. And we'll also hear from Reconciliation Australia's Ngarra Ngunnawalli work as well. So as you all are living through, as we all are living through, the landscape of early childhood education and care across Australia continues to evolve with a strong emphasis on quality, access, workforce and reform. So I'm going to go over some key pieces of reform, predominantly national, just to keep everyone in the loop and remind everybody there's a lot of moving pieces which we will all benefit from, and also it's useful to be aware of. The first and probably the most immediate one is the review into child safety arrangements under the National Quality Framework, which was published and communicated nationally on the 21st of December 2023. We did a consultation on the 18th of January with a small group of representatives from the sector. And please accept my warmest thanks to those colleagues who participated in that, and warmest thanks to the colleagues who organised it as well at such short notice. It was commissioned by the Australian Government and Education Ministers and undertaken by the Australian Children's Education and Care Authority, ASIQA. And the review looked at how well the National Quality Framework operates in the context of child safety, but also how the National Quality Framework and regulatory authorities engage with other jurisdictional laws that are for child safety and other agencies that uphold child safety too, policing, working with vulnerable people, checks, etc. The terms of reference are on the SEEK website if you'd like to look them up. The review confirmed that the NQF remains robust and focused on continuous improvement and makes 16 recommendations to further strengthen child safe governance, leadership and culture, prevention and early intervention, educator safeguards and teacher registration accreditation, support for staff to respond to and manage risks, and child safety arrangements across jurisdictions. These recommendations also build on the other child safety aspects, such as safety during transport, sleeping, and during evacuations. And Lisa McCoy has kindly come down from Brisbane or Sydney, or one of the places where Lisa works from, to give us a presentation of more detail about that report, what a CEQA found, and some of the recommendations there. The other important piece of work is the National Early Childhood Education Care Workforce Strategy. In 2019, education ministers endorsed an approach to do a national workforce strategy. It feels like the other day, but it actually, you know, on the way to 5 years ago. And that led to consultation. Again, it was led by a CEQA. And then we developed a national plan, which is 21 actions. And the National Workforce Strategy is called Shaping Our Future. It's a 10-year time frame, and recognising the complexity of the workforce challenges faced by our sector. And the six areas of focus: professional recognition, attraction and retention, well-being, leadership and capability, qualifications and career pathways, and data and evidence. In September 22, we published an implementation and evaluation plan, along with a summary of where those initiatives were up to. It's on a thing called the Shaping Our Future dashboard. And strongly recommend everybody having a look at that to see where everything's up to. But that also has a great summary of all state and territory contributions to that national workforce. The ACT has its own workforce strategy that closely aligns with the national strategy. And the Valuing Educators Reference Group, which is formed under that strategy, met for the first time last week, and there are some colleagues who are on that group who are with us today. So thank you, those colleagues who are participating in that as well. The online, there's also a workforce snapshot that brings together a range of different data. In that context, I'd also like to welcome Lyndall Reed, who's the Chief Executive of the Teachers Quality Institute. And this week has been I think is the milestone week where the registration of early childhood teachers has started. And I think there was a race for a range of people who wanted to get card number one for that or some special number from that process. And there are a lot of early adopters in the room with us today. So congratulations, Lyndall, to you and your own team, and thank you for coming today. Out of the National Workforce Strategy, we also had the first National Workforce Forum, which was in November 2023. And this was to bring together governments, representatives of peak bodies, unions, some large national early childhood education care providers, service leaders, educators, research organisations, universities and teaching institutions. It was a very rich forum. And we discussed 11 of the most pressing 21 actions out of the National Workforce Strategy. We also welcomed the Productivity Commission, which they gave a summary of their work, of where they were up to at the time. I think they're close to finishing, if not finishing. Is that right? I've lost track. There's so many. But that was a great exchange of information. It was really unique, I'd have to say, for commissioners. First of all, the Commissioners of Productivity Commission to come and be face-to-face with a great representation of the sector, but also to be au fait about the topics that we were talking about. So it was a really genuine exchange, and I felt that there was a very productive conversation. We also heard from a whole range of organisations and presenters from governments and key stakeholders who are part of the workforce strategy, with many ideas about how to improve quality, how to retain people, the issues that everybody's dealing with, how to build quality in terms of staff. And Professor Sheila Degatati gave a presentation with her colleagues from Macquarie University, and we're going to hear a version of that presentation today. I think it was probably the one where everyone was really quiet and paying a lot of attention, because workforce pay and conditions is what... there's a reason it's the first item in the whole workforce strategy, because it's the most pressing. I just wanted to remind two people about the NQF review. I know it seems like forever ago, but all of the work that was done in that review is still rolling out, so we will see some more changes come through this year. Claire and Kylie and the team will make sure that everyone's up to date with our seeker channels to say this is started now. And sometimes people think, didn't that start already? But there are some things that it's quite scheduled. The next thing I wanted to mention, there's a lot going on, is the National Workforce Census. I can't stress how important the National Workforce Census is at this time in the history of the sector. It's a unique data collection that provides a national overview of the early childhood education and care workforce to help inform governments and other policymakers and regulators about what's happening. It's such an important piece of work. We've been all hanging out for it to happen. I know it's probably the last thing you want to do is fill out another thing, but this is it's a benchmark in the progress of the workforce. It is mandatory for all childcare subsidy approved providers to participate, and I strongly encourage all other early childhood services that are not registered with CCS to complete it as well. So if you're from a government preschool or a non-government school preschool that doesn't rely on CCS, please make sure that things are in play for you to complete the census. The registration period is open now. Registration period ends on the 26th of April, so if you haven't registered already, please do so. Please make a time in your calendar to do that. The collection period is 13th of May to 14th of July. Again, please make time to book that in. It is so important. That's really key data. And the last time we did the census for the ACT, it was a very important piece of work in terms of explaining what's happening with the sector and what are the best things we can do to support the sector. Early childhood scholarship program, the uptake of the ACT's early childhood tertiary degree scholarship program continues to rise. I think we've reached 100 or more awarded under the scholarship since it started. There are 16 to be had this year. The first half of this year will have 8. That will go out in a couple of weeks, so please keep an eye on that. I just wanted to emphasise anyone who's already halfway through their qualification or done a year or two, it doesn't matter. You're still eligible for it. It's $25,000 per student. There's funding to support backfill for services and providers when students have to go on prac. For those who want to get a real life experience of what it's like to work in the quality assurance team and go on assessment and rating, you can join Seeker for a month under that program as well. So a couple of weeks, keep an eye out for that. That'll be 8. Oh, the other thing I always mention with this is if you're a provider and you want to double, we'll go halves together and we'll double the number of students. So we're always open to that. And every student we get on the program is another piece of investment in our sector. I'd like to now welcome Professor Sheila Degatati to talk about the Workforce 1.1 research that she's done. Sheila specialises in infant toddler pedagogies and learning in early childhood, Education and is an experienced co-researcher in projects that aim to inform early childhood enrollment attendance, processes of health communication by both early childhood and health organisations. And Sheila also researches to improve early childhood education systems, and she led the Early Childhood National Workforce Strategy research on workforce pay and conditions. Please welcome Sheila.
Thanks very much, Sean. I have to remember how to use a clicker. I'm hopeless with these things. Can you hear me? Is that okay? Perfect. Thank you. I'm a little bit croaky, so bear with me. Can I just start by saying how delighted I am to be here and presenting on this work? It's really important work, and we're hoping that it will absolutely inform the workforce strategy going forward. Can I also start as well by acknowledging the land that we're on today and acknowledging that traditional owners of that land, and pay my respect, please, to elders past, present and future, and extend that respect to all Indigenous colleagues in the room today. So, as a bit of a background for this, it doesn't feel like I'm projecting at all, but I obviously am. As a bit of a background for this, this work was commissioned through the ACT government on behalf of all states and territory governments and the federal government to look into this issue of pay and conditions in the early childhood workforce. My background, as a way of introduction, I originally started work as an early childhood teacher. I worked for a number of years as a teacher and as a director and as an inclusion support worker, all of those wonderful different roles that you can have in early childhood, before I then entered into academia. And I've been working for Macquarie University now for, over 20 years. Now I'm starting to feel old. Over 20 years as a early childhood lecturer and as an early childhood researcher as well. As Sean said, my main area has always been looking at infant and toddler pedagogy and curriculum. And I don't know if I've met any of you, either at workshops or at other presentations. Am I familiar to any of you? A few people? Yes, hi. I've done work in that area for some time. But in the recent years, I've also gone into looking at early childhood systems, because I think I've got that history in early childhood. I've got, a strong connection with the sector. And I care very, very deeply about what happens in the sector. And I also am a passionate advocate for the importance of high quality early childhood education. So when this opportunity came along to look at pay and conditions, myself and a team of researchers at Macquarie University, we jumped at that opportunity. So also, before I go into the nitty-gritty, I want to just acknowledge that I am just one of a team of thousands, as you can see up there. We are actually a multidisciplinary group that conducted this research. There's myself and Tamara Cummings and Natalie Brand, and we specialise in early childhood education. But also we have Professor Louise Thornthwaite, Rebecca Mitchell, Kopal Singer, Yan-Yan Ju, Jun Gu, and Lee Khan, Dan Dan, and Maria. And they are all specialising in different aspects of workforce, of workers' well-being, of workforce relations, of economic modelling, and so on and so forth. So we came together as this multidisciplinary team to really approach the issue of pay and conditions in an informed way from that diverse context. So, as part of the context, and I'm not going to dwell on this because you know it, as part of a context, you know that we have a workforce shortage, and you probably know a number of reasons why we have a workforce shortage. But the purpose of this research was to get the data that supports some of these issues that we all know that we're facing. So this graph here that actually only goes up to June 2023, there's a couple of other graphs now, is a graph of the employment vacancies that are advertised in the sector. And as you can see, they have been going up and up and up. So it's showing very clearly that we've got more vacancies, we're finding it harder to fill those vacancies, and also we've got more attrition. in the sector as well. People are leaving the sector. What we wanted to do in this research was to give value to the voices of the sector. We wanted to allow the sector to speak and have that opportunity to speak directly to the education ministers to tell them why we have got ourselves into, well, not we have got ourselves into this situation, why the country has got itself into this situation. So this was a comment here that I found particularly pertinent, I guess, and very representative of some of the comments from a national survey that we did. And she said, you know, I stay in my service because I work in a regional area where there's simply no other professional jobs that I'm qualified for. I stay in the sector because it's the degree I did many years at university and because I love children. And I was thinking I'm going to make a difference and be a great teacher. There's never been an option for me to train in a different field. I wish somewhere along the line I could do that because I am deeply unhappy in my job. Now, to me, that really struck me to the core, to think that somebody felt that they had no other options to continue in the job that they were doing, despite the fact that they were deeply unhappy, and that the passion for the work of working with young children seemed to have been sucked out of this particular respondent. So we took this on board. This is what somebody else told us. Listen to what we're saying. We're in a crisis. We are stretched thin, and every day we have the responsibilities of the lives of staff, children, and families in our hands. So listen to what we are saying. So we really took that on board with this particular report, and we wanted to represent as truthfully and honestly as possible what the sector and many of you in the room probably participated, maybe in the survey or in the focus groups or whatever that we ran. We wanted to honour what you were saying. So really quickly, here's what we did. We conducted the research in three phases. The first phase, we did a comprehensive analysis of the industrial relationships landscape of early childhood education. And I can tell you a little bit more about that. But we looked at the enterprise agreements. We looked at the national awards. We benchmarked between them just as a way of getting a little bit of interaction going. How many enterprise agreements that cover early childhood staff do you think there are in Australia today? Shout out a number. Somebody be brave. How many? 50? More? Less? 100? Keep going. Keep going. How many? Oh, you're all very quiet. any advances on 100? We found ones that are current. We found over 500 enterprise agreements. All were different. Every single one of them had different conditions and so on. So that's just one little tiny aspect of the industrial landscape that we're working in today. So is it no wonder that quite often Facebook sites are full of people asking, what am I supposed to be paid? Am I supposed to get paid lunch breaks? Am I supposed to get paid sick leave, et cetera, et cetera? It's probably no wonder. Because if you go and work at a centre down the road, you're going to be employed under completely different conditions than where you are. So that's one thing to think about. We also looked at the literature to see what international and national research was telling us about pay and conditions. We then went into phase two, where we did some interviews with people in organisations to ask them about their perspective and staff in those organisations. To ask them about their perspectives about this issue. We did a national survey where we got over 1,000 results, responses, where we again asked for their perspectives. And then we finished off with an economic analysis. So from the recommendations, from the results, we actually did some economic modelling to say how much is this going to cost and how much impact is this going to have on attraction and retention of staff. So now I'm going, one more bit. the other thing that I forgot to mention, we had a stakeholder advisory committee as well. So we consulted with them all the way through. So we were trying as hard as we could to make sure the kind of questions, the kind of issues that we were asking about were representative of the issues that were being faced in the sector as well. So again, you know, we have huge gratitude for the people who were involved in those stakeholder groups. Okay, we're going to swap now, and I'm going to get you at your table. You actually need to get a device, some kind of phone or something like that. You all have a smartphone, because we're going to do a little Mentimeter. And I'm going to ask you to write down, what do you think? You've got up to 5 words that you can enter. What do you think are the 5 greatest barriers at the moment to attraction and retention in the early childhood sector? Get the magnifying glass out. Okay, so we can see there that pay is a big issue. The bigger the word, obviously, the more people have written that word down. So pay, recognition is a critical issue. And I think that's something that we've been struggling with for a long time, is the recognition of ourselves as educational professionals and as essential workers within the society. Conditions, workload, burnout. Yeah. Expectations, responsibilities. So obviously it's more than just pay. There's other things going on as well. Long hours. There's a lot of things about workload. I can't read those things now. It's all got too small. I should have maybe only do 3 words. But you can see there, though, it's not just about pay. We hear a lot about pay, and I'm certainly not saying that pay is not important. Pay is absolutely critical to improving attraction and retention. But there are a whole lot of other things going on. Now, our research, and I don't know if this is going to help at all, if we can go back to the slides, our research showed a number of things were going on. And this is a synthesis of everything that we found, and we ended up putting together this model to show how pay and conditions were related to attraction and retention. And so on the left-hand side here, you can see pay and employment conditions are really important, and things that are related to that, things, barriers that are currently in place there that is stopping the pay and conditions from getting better, are things like we've got so many different early childhood education funding models between states and territories, between the federal government, between jurisdictions. We're also a parent-subsidized model as well. So any increase in pay and conditions means that parents or government, one or t'other, has to pay for it. So we've got those kind of barriers. We've got the provider landscape as well. We've got profits, not-for-profits. We've got preschool, long daycare. We've got departments of education. We've got schools. We've got a whole lot of different types of early childhood services, management structures, that again means that with theirs, each one of those have different priorities, different agendas, different motivations, and so on and so forth. Historically low wages, and that's where that recognition comes in. Historically, early childhood educators and early childhood teachers have been paid lower than comparable workers in other sectors. Now, one of the big things that has happened in the last year or so is that the Industrial Relations, the Fair Work Act has changed, which means that the low conditions and low wages that have historically been, because let's face it, it was seen as women's work. Apologies to all of our gentlemen in the room, but that was one of the main things. That has been changed, so that can now be challenged. And it is being successfully challenged now in the Fair Work Commission, which is really positive. But we've got that historical low wages and low conditions. And we've also, as I said, got low coverage of EAs, despite the fact that there's over 500 EAs, enterprise agreements. We've actually got low coverage. More early childhood educators and teachers are covered by the national award, which is low, than by enterprise agreements. The majority of those enterprise agreements are actually standalone services. Obviously, some of our large providers have them. They are very, I think, we only found a couple as well of private providers who have enterprise agreements. They tend to have individual arrangements. So all of those barriers contribute towards the paying conditions that we have now. But you can see here, there's a great big gap between the paying conditions and the attraction and retention of staff, because there's so many other things that are coming into play. So again, workload was a huge barrier to attraction and retention, and I'll go through some of these in a moment. Employment opportunities and options. Early childhood educators and teachers now have more options than they did. Early childhood teachers often can go into schools. They're qualified to go into schools. Early childhood educators can go into other either related professions or other related jobs and earn more and have better conditions. There are those options. We have some policy barriers as well in relation to immigration, fringe benefits, tax, and so on. I won't go into those, but they're barriers. A positive thing, green, yay, with there's enablers as well. And I'll talk about these a little bit later. In terms of workforce support, organisational climate, and career development and progression. And we're seeing a lot of fantastic work that is being done either at the state or territory level. And Sean was talking about things like scholarships and, you know, supports that are there to encourage people to enter the profession. There's some fantastic work that's being done in individual services or in organisations that actually will support attraction and retention. So that's a positive. These, though, all filter through individual differences. We know we're a diverse sector. We know every educator, every teacher is going to be different in what they bring. So there's no one-size-fits-all that is going to help the entire sector. What is going to need to happen is that organisations supported through policy reform, supported through workforce relations reform, organisations, whether they be small or large, are going to have to think about providing a suite, a collection of different ways that will support their educators to come into the sector and to be retained in the sector. So talking about retaining in the sector, here's the next question, and we'll swap to Mentimeter in a second. Is this Mentimeter? Yes, it is. Yes. Here's the next question. In terms of retention, and you can only choose one answer, I hope, if I've set it up correctly. How many, what proportion of educators from our survey we asked, how likely are you to leave this sector, not your service, but this sector in the next 2 years? How many of our respondents said that they were likely to leave in 2 years? Okay, so the consensus is that 50%. Well, I suppose that's a little bit of good news if we can go back to our slides, because in our survey, nearly 45% of respondents said that they were likely to leave the sector within 2 years. But as you can see, we also gave them a not sure. So this is the yellow in the middle. The yellow is don't really know. So they were sitting on the fence. If you add those ones in, you've actually only got a third of educators who said, no, I will not be leaving the sector in the next 2 years. So that was pretty scary. So again, that is indicative of where we are currently at. So let's unpack some of this. Here we go. Pay. Pay was the most important thing that came up throughout all of our work. It was all about pay. And I've written that heading there, not to try and be a bit facetious, but we had a number of responses when we asked educators and in the survey what needs to change. And this was one direct quote, but we had quite a lot of those. We had quite a lot of pay kind of responses. So you can read there the kind of comments. I'll let you have just a read. of why people are saying that pay is so important. So you can see there the issue of it's just simply not enough for cost of living. It's not a living wage. You can also see people saying there's better options. I can go into the admin support and earn a better wage, or I can go into schools and earn a better wage. So people have the options and they are exercising those options with their feet. So what we did in the survey, I'll tell you about this now because I'm going to show you a few graphs. Sorry for those of you who don't like statistics. What we did, we had a particular method in the survey where we said, imagine you've decided you're leaving your job. You're leaving your current job because you've been given two job offers at two other services. And we asked people to look at the conditions for these two services and say, which one is more preferable to you? And one of the conditions that we played off against the other was you've got a pay rise. It's either you haven't, this job offer is not going to give you a pay rise. This job offer could give you a 10%, a 20%, or a 25% pay rise. And then we had other conditions that we also played off against each other as well. So it wasn't just pay that they were comparing. They compared that you might not get a pay rise, but you'll get 2 weeks extra leave. Or you'll get a 25% pay rise, but you don't get any extra leave, but you get two extra hours of non-contact time a week. So you can see how people had to juggle and decide what was best for them. Now, what I've done here is I'm presenting where the sweet spot is in terms of pay, what this told us, because we gave a whole lot of these scenarios and we're able then to work out what's going to make a difference. So here's the graph here. This is what people were saying. 15% pay rise, okay, but you can see the increase in preference for 20% pay rise, and you can also see 25% pay rise is obviously better. But that real sweet spot, it's basically saying, don't even think about it if we're going to go for less than 20%. We deserve 20%. That's what's going to make a difference. Now, there were some nuances here because we also asked people, how much are you currently being paid? Are you being paid at award? Are you being paid 10% above award? And the red line is over 10% above award. So you can still see that sharp increase going up to 20%. Every single one of those three different groups was still saying 10%, but you can see that people who were already paid 10% over award had a slightly lower preference for it than those who were at award or up to 10% at award. So, yeah, 20% pay rise is what the educators are asking for, preferably 25%. We didn't ask higher than that. Maybe we should have done. Some nuances, though, now. As I said, we had huge, when we looked at the awards, we had huge disparities between these different enterprise agreements. People tend to think if I'm on an enterprise agreement, I will be paid better than the award. We actually found some agreements that where people were being paid less than the award. Now, that was scary. Shouldn't happen, but it did happen. But everything from a couple of percent above the award to, I know what organisation I'm going to work with if I go back to teaching, 30% higher than the award was the highest one that we found. So with huge range, you can see. People were really worried, and I understand where this is coming from. They were saying, yes, we need a pay rise, but don't make the parents pay for it. The parents can't afford to pay anymore. So there's that kind of self-sacrificing, ethic of care towards the communities that they're working with, that came through in our data as well. family daycare services. I don't know if any of you here are in family daycare services. There is a childcare subsidy inequity with the family daycare services, and that has an implication for how much family daycare educators are actually able to earn. So there are inequities there. And there's also current barriers, enablers to provider level financial benefits in terms of fringe benefits tax and all of those kind of legislated tax-based issues also provide barriers. So here's the next question for you with Menti, and you can actually just type down a reply. Obviously, pay is really important, but do you think that increasing pay and remuneration alone, is that going to fix the workforce shortage? If yes, by all means, write yes. If no, what else needs to be dealt with? What else do we need to look at? So, okay, we've got a predominance of no's. Somebody said workload. Anything else that we need to address? The respect. Yep. Anything else? Recognition. So that goes, yeah, hand in hand with respect. Absolutely. Sorry, there's a lot of emphasis on teachers. Yep. Okay, but not in terms of early learning. Yeah, yeah. We're still seen as babysitters, childminders, and so on and so forth. And so that, yeah, that professional respect absolutely has to be addressed. Okay, so I will move on. Because the second most important issue that came out in our research, I need to keep an eye on the time. Lost my watch. No, I'm okay. I've got half an hour. Yep, okay. Oops, was workload. Okay. People were saying, you can pay me more, but until you address the workload, no amount of pay will compensate for what we're now being asked to do. And so, again, we had these comments. Our team is burning out. And so you can see here, we asked in the survey, what do you think needs to improve if we're going to retain and attract more educators? And you can see there that level of pay was just a little bit ahead, but the next three things down are all related to workload. So having enough time to do the work that I have to do, having enough paid in the paid workday. Paid non-contact time came up as a really critical issue. And overtime rates for when, you know, when we're asked to stay back for staff meetings, when we're asked to go to professional development and so on and so forth. Please stop paying us pizza. That came up, you know, or, you know, discounts at Coles. Sorry. That came up. So questions like stop with the never-ending paperwork. Is this familiar? Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this was obviously a family daycare comment here. Family daycare will just die. It's impossible for us to do everything that is required. And the work-life balance is impossible. I need a greater time off the floor so that I don't have to compromise on quality in order to maintain my sanity. So we had a lot of comments about the well-being of educators that was really suffering because of the high workload. So again, going back to that survey where we asked people to trade things off against each other, we asked about non-contact time. So your job might give you a 15% pay rise, but you might be given six more hours of non-contact time, as opposed to another one that gave you 25% pay rise, but you didn't get any non-contact time. Which one would you prefer? And again, repeating over eight scenarios that we gave, this is what it showed. People were very grateful, even for another 2 hours. Interestingly, between 2 and 4 hours didn't make a difference. There was pretty much no movement there, but then 6 hours again. So 6 hours was best, but even 2 hours, educators were saying that's going to help. We then thought, okay, what about between sectors? So what about between long day care or occasional care services, preschool or kindergarten services, and out-of-school hours care. We weren't able to put family daycare into this analysis because family daycare don't get non-paid, non-contact time. They have a different structure to how they operate. So we weren't able to put those in. But you can see here that preschool and kindergarten, they weren't so persuaded by extra non-contact time. And I rationalise that going, well, they get more paid holidays. They can do a lot of this stuff in that time. And also, generally, 9 to 3, 8:30 to 3:30, they have a little bit more time to do this work than long daycare services and out-of-school hours care. But you can see for long daycare, people working in long daycare services, this paid non-contact time was really important for them. And yes.
Are we talking about non-contact time or additional leave? Because there were also additional leave.
On the right.
On the right. Oh, sorry. No, it should say non-contact time. Sorry. I need to check that. That might be a mistake. But generally speaking, what I've said is true. Thank you for picking out the purposeful mistake in my presentation. Nobody picked that out last time. Got away with that one last time around. I will check that and I'll get back to you. But basically, yeah, non-contact time was the critical thing. But thinking about, so again, some of those nuances, here were some of the comments that people were saying. You can read that first one. 3 hours for an educational leader to be responsible for the whole service is BS. That's what they said. In terms of paperwork, doubling, tripling, quadrupling, it takes us away for caring for and educating the children. People were telling us that they spent so much time trying to do paperwork that they could not do the job that they wanted to do. Also, you know, as say, you know, we're looking at additional with the inclusion practices now, which I have to say the people in the survey were really supportive of this, but they were saying it is increasing our workload and we need more support in order to do this critical work because of its flow through. And then, I hate to say this, but there were some pretty scathing comments about the quality of qualified staff that were coming through. And that hurts me to say that, but I don't know, is that familiar? Some people are nodding. And that increases the workload of the current people in the service because you're having to mentor, you're having to train, you're having to try to get these people up to scratch. And so it takes away, again, from your ability to do your job. Okay. So here's the last question. We might leave it from Menti. So obviously I looked at non-contact time there. Is non-contact time, though, the only critical issue? Are there other issues that we need to think about?
You're lying, comment.
Sorry, say again.
I think sometimes there's a really big discrepancy between providers and company and then, like, the equal, like, what's actually required.
Yep.
Best practice and trying to be exceeding or even better than that. I think sometimes providers and organisations just go so big.
Yeah.
That
okay. I don't know if people at the back heard that, but it was about having discrepancies between providers in terms of what they expect in terms of documentation, paperwork, administration, that some providers maybe are going way above and beyond in terms of what they are expecting of their staff. And one of the recommendations that we put forward with this work was that there needs to be a comprehensive audit of regulatory bodies as well as a CEQA to say what is necessary so that educators and teachers understand what is necessary rather than what do you think that you have to do. Because, again, there's a lot of misinformation out there and educators really stress about this. You know, do I have to do a daily diary for every single child in my class every single day? I won't say that too loud. Okay, what else? Leave. Leave was important. Again, this is from our survey. You can see that pay was the highest thing. Paid non-contact time was the next highest priority. But leave was also a high priority. And what was coming up? The inequity between long daycare services, preschool, primary, secondary services in terms of the leave that is available. Family daycare, again, well, they only get leave if they give themselves leave. And it can be very, very difficult for a family daycare educator to organise that into their day unless they are supported by a great scheme who's able to help them to manage that. Sick leave. We get sick all the time. We all know that. We're a highly contagious site. So it's not just about annual leave. It's about sick leave and being able to take leave flexibly, because also the majority of people who work in early childhood education also have children of their own or are in caring roles of their own. So they're not only just looking after themselves, they're looking after their own children as well, who are also getting sick. So this was a priority as well. How, you know, give us more leave, but allow us to take that leave flexibly. So if I need to take that leave to look after my sick children, that's not going to mean that I have to take leave without pay when I get sick, probably from my sick children. So allow me to use my annual leave. Allow me to use my RDOs. Sorry, I didn't put all this up. Allow me to use that leave flexibly. So again, here's our graph. How much extra leave do people want? Again, here's some nuances. People were saying 6 or 9 more days would be really important. If they already were given substantial leave, this wasn't nearly as important for them. So again, looking then at our different sectors, you can see here the green line is people who work in preschool, kindergarten. Yeah, you know, a few more days would be lovely, but not so keen on that, as opposed to those working in long daycare services where that was a really critical issue for them. It's not only leave, though, it's also about flexibility. The sector wants flexibility. They want the flexibility to be able to work part-time, to maybe have shorter days. They want to have that flexibility to work around family commitments. But also we were hearing that a number of people within the sector also wanted to have the flexibility so that they might be able to balance up some work in an early childhood centre, maybe with some work in an inclusion support agency or something like that. And, you know, that could be a really positive thing to have people working across the sectors that work very closely together. So flexibility was also a critical issue. Final thing that we looked at, and this was related to paid professional learning. And what we found really interesting, we asked people again in the survey, you might get a 15% pay rise, you might not get any extra leave, you might get 2 hours of paid non-contact time, but you're going to get $300 worth of paid professional learning a year. Balance that off against the other options. What we found was that unless you got to $450 worth of paid professional learning a year, people were actually negative about this when it came to attraction. Remembering this is an attraction thing. People basically said, don't bother. Now, why that's the case, I'm not sure. Maybe it's kind of, you know, don't try to buy me off with a little bit of a workshop or two rather than give me these other conditions. I'm not sure. What we found, though, was that it was absolutely critical for retention. So if you remember that 40% of people who were going to leave the profession versus the nearly 33% or whatever it was of people who were saying they were going to stay, you can see here that those people, we asked them, how much paid professional development do you have currently? People who were saying that they had no paid professional development entitlements at the moment, 71% of those people said that they were most likely to be leaving in 2 years. Whereas go right up to the top, if they had $400 worth, or they estimated they had around about $400 worth a year of paid professional development, now we're up to only 40% of those people were saying that they were going to leave. They were high intent to leave. So it really is a critical retention thing. And why was it critical? Not only for professional professional growth, but also for feeling valued. And this came through really, really strongly. When we asked educators in the interviews, why do you stay at this organization? They were saying things like, you know what, we have got the best professional learning calendar and system, or I'm allowed to go to this conference. Every year we have this conference, or I'm allowed to go to that conference, and therefore I get the opportunity to network and so on and so forth. So it wasn't only about professional growth in themselves. It was about feeling connected not only to their organization and recognizing that their organization was going the extra mile so that they could have those opportunities, but also that opportunity to network with their peers. So it comes down to, again, that well-being kind of issue. Okay. So just summing up these barriers, as I said, the workforce relation, you can't read that, but the number of EAs, the low awareness among educators of what their rights actually are. We were, you know, people were saying in the survey, I have no idea. I don't know. When we asked them, are you paid at award or above award? We had the option of, I don't know. I think we had 30% of our people saying, I don't know. There's a low awareness of what people are actually entitled to or how to find out about these things, and the wide variation. We also have policy barriers. I mentioned those earlier. The fact that we have different states and territories all have different systems, all have different funding models, all have different initiatives. Some of those, you know, many of those initiatives are fantastic, but we're also competing against each other as well between the states and territories. So there's a number of things that are going on there. How am I going for time? I've got a little bit more. Okay, so now for some good news. Enablers, these were the green ones in that model. We absolutely found that there were things that were working in terms of attracting, but in particular in terms of retaining staff. So that importance of attending to well-being was absolutely critical. Educators were telling us, I work at a fantastic service. We look after each other. We have special events every now and then, or we have these kind of initiatives. Our director does this for us every now and then, and so on and so forth. We're allowed to have flexi days, and that looking after people's well-being was absolutely critical, and it worked. It absolutely worked. We spoke to some services who basically said that they had minimal turnover for the last 15 years. Staff are so loyal to that service. They love going to work there. Also, that creating a culture of valuing and belonging really worked. And that was often came through having a clear philosophy, organizational philosophy, whether that be at the individual service level or at the provider level, a clear philosophy, a clear ethic of care and ethic of service delivery, that then the staff could see that was lived through every single decision that was made in that organization. And that, again, really bred loyalty. And we had people who were saying, you could pay me 50% more, but I will always work for this organization because this organization aligns with my values. And I can see that this organization really wants to do the best by the staff and the children and the communities. So you can see there's some quotes here from our interviews and from our surveys. You can see talking about everybody contributing. It's that group culture. Everyone's contributing. When we need extra support, I've always felt comfortable. I can go and ask for support. The managers do a really good job of listening. They really care about their staff. Talking about, that motivation behind offering above award conditions is to maintain a position of being the employer of choice. Organisations were saying, we want to be the employer of choice, so we're willing to go the extra mile so that we can position ourselves there. Talking about just, being friendly was seen as so critical, being friendly and being supportive and caring about each other. And also, though, the other thing was that people, the staff in particular, valued when their organisation had high standards. They didn't just accept anything because then they felt that they were working for an organisation or a service that, as I said, lived their values and that had high expectation for the staff but were able to then support their staff to meet those high expectations. So where do we go from here? This is a very busy slide and half of it's missing. I'll go back and forward again. Here we are. Back to our model. It's a bit blurry, sorry. So the report of this work is currently with the education ministers. So it's there. We're waiting for a response from them. They know all of this work that's been done. I guess I have to acknowledge, like Sean was saying earlier, this was also in the context of an awful lot of other work that's going on. The Productivity Commission, the ACCC inquiry, the early years strategy that is being formulated at the moment, as well as the ongoing workforce strategy as well. What is really encouraging from my perspective is that for the first time that I can remember, all of these different commissions and inquiries and so on all seem to be singing from the same song sheet. They all recognise that you cannot have a high quality and accessible early childhood education system unless you look after the staff, unless we address this issue. So time will tell what happens, but I think this is my last question and I'm happy to, I think we've got a roving mic. Love for your feedback, your thoughts on, okay, collectively, I mean, I can jump up and down. I'm just one person and I'm an academic and politicians don't like to listen to us very much, okay, but they will listen to you guys. They will. So what can we do collectively to ensure that the pay and the conditions and therefore the attraction and retention of early childhood staff is bolstered in the near future, because that's what we need? So that's my question to you. Wave your arm around if you have something to say. What can we do? Oh, there's a hand over there. I'm asking you to put on your advocacy hat. I like cheeky.
And back to you. With a scenario, I should introduce myself. Amanda Walsh from the Community and Community Council in Australia. If, for example, come the May federal budget, the Australian government announced a 15% pay rise for all educators, and then the Fair Work Commission, so the Fair Work Commission can bump that up to 25%, which is exactly what's happened in aged care. If an announcement comes in May, what can we do, like what should our next step be based on your research to make an impact to start attracting people to the sector?
Big question. I am hoping that there will be an announcement relatively shortly about pay and that what has happened in the aged care sector gives me reason for hope. What can we do as a sector? I think I kind of know what I would do. I'll be jumping up and down. I'll be speaking to my colleagues here and going, what else can we do to get the ear of the minister? But what can you do? I'm not in a position to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. I mean, who wants to answer that question? Mike's on its way. Yeah, okay. And I'll hold on a second. It's there, and then we'll come to you in the front. So, yep.
Hi, Leanne. Hi, Leanne. For 18 years. One of the big things that you can do, I know that a lot of you will roll your eyes and groan, is you can join the union.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things for the multi-enterprise bargaining that's going on at the moment for the 25% increase, you have to be a union member to join the broker union stage after the union.
Yeah.
So if they do turn around and say that they're going to fund 25% and 15%, the only way that you and your service and your provider can get in on that is by being a union member. And the union then broke you into the next stage. You can't just get 25, depending on how the government turn around and say they're going to fund with that increase. But at this stage, that's the only way you can get in on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, in early childhood education, we traditionally have a low union membership. So I'm not going to advocate for you to join the union, but Leanne over there just has. There was a hand up the front here. Hi.
I've been starting at the school service level, understanding and knowing your team wants and working with them, supporting them through that. Yes, everything has to come from higher ups and company level, but actually advocating and supporting with your team to make those changes as well.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think coming from if we go at this as a whole lot of individuals, then it's not going to happen. It's a matter of coming at it within either individual teams, within individual organizations, and so on. And I think one of the really important things to do is to talk about it. Talk about it with members of your team. Do you know what you're earning according to the award? Do you know what your entitlements are? And have a staff meeting around, okay, what are our entitlements and how do they compare with the national award? You can go onto Fair Work Commission website and find that national award. Okay, again, it's about it making it visible. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Leah Tang, the General Manager for Education and Early Learning.
Hi.
I think we need to talk a lot about how critical the early learning is for childhood development. And I think we're starting to do that. But, you know, I started my life as a secondary science teacher, and when I was teaching physics, people spoke to me as though I was an adult. When I moved into teaching primary school, they spoke to me as though I was six. Now I've moved into early learning because I know that is where you make the biggest difference in child's life, and you can start at that earliest stage. You can make an enormous difference in their life and in their learning and in the whole trajectory of their life. And I think we need to communicate that in a really intellectual manner, you know, and not necessarily talking about how, you know, whether psychologists, social workers, all of those sorts of things, but to genuinely talk about how important early education is.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be enormous advocates for that, and then we need to recruit every other educator, every other profession to talk about how critical those early years are and how important the goals of the early educators are in children's lives.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think the language that we use as well when talking about what we do is critical. And I'm a little bit hopeful because I have seen a shift in the language. I don't know any of you who were at the Early Childhood Australia conference, not last year, the year before, and Jason Clare spoke. Was anybody there? Yeah. And he said the first thing he was told when he came into office was don't use the word childcare. It's early childhood education and care. And he made a slip at one point and everybody in the room went, and told him off. But we have seen that shift. And I think some of that shift in the discourse. But I agree with you. Claiming the professional knowledge base and the specialisation that we have and being able to articulate that to parents, articulate it to the broader community and so on, I think is a really critical thing. So, yeah. And, you know, we need to start, the government is talking about, you know, having broader social media campaigns about that. And they're coming up on my feed at the moment. Is it Brighter Beginnings? Is it right? Yeah. About how important the first 2,000 years, 2,000 days what life is. Now I'm really feeling old. That first 2,000 days is so critical. Yeah, yeah. We might have time for, I think we've got a couple more, but then I think we're running out of time. Yeah, hi. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
My name is Mete. I'm a football writer for Next Common Thank You. My question is, first before I said, I need to say thank you to Elon Musk for experiencing all the efforts you try to put in value into the sector. My question is, when she said 25, eventually there's a 25% increase approved by federal officials, how is that going to impact public educators? Because we put in a lot of effort, flexibility, everything we've done in all your research. I don't think anybody can actually do it for students. I don't know, possible for family to get up the same education or something.
Yeah. It was something that came up in our findings. We worked quite closely with Family Daycare, the National Family Daycare, Family Daycare Australia, to help to capture the voices of family daycare educators. But it did come up very clearly that because family daycare educators have a completely different work model, employment model, than centre-based services, that needs to be looked at really, really closely. Because yes, if, and I mean, it's the same with centre-based organisations. If suddenly organisations, providers are having to pay all their staff 25% more without the government coming in and saying, and we are going to fund that, it's parents who have to pay it. And parents will continue to stop using early childhood services. So, yeah. I think that context, so again, going through Family Daycare Australia, going through your organisations, through your providers, to make sure that any negotiations also are inclusive of family daycare services because of the critical work that you guys do, we absolutely need to make sure that no service type is disadvantaged by the pay rise. And really the only way of doing it without hitting parents is by governments to fully subsidise any pay rise. That's the only way that it can happen. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you so much. Do we have one last question?
Hi. Jill, I just wonder if there do you have any research and what kind of connections and conversations you had with regards to people leaving the industry for an agency role due to the pay disparity that's I'm personally super prevalent in case of people leaving parent positions to benefit from the agency sort of side of things. And also, another question, is there any plans in the future to sort of work more evenly with agencies with regards to the visa structure in order to have a really foundation of knowledge for those coming into the industry?
Yeah. We did hear it was anecdotal stuff and qualitative responses that came through the survey. People were saying permanent staff are leaving because they earn more being casual. They didn't specifically mention agencies, but I suspect that that is the case. And so the over casualization did certainly come up as an issue in terms of workload as well. That when people are working with so many casual staff, that is also impacting on workload. So that was something that came up. In terms of visas, that was also something that came up when we talked to providers and we asked people from the executive of the providers what needs to change, and they did talk about reviewing visa structures and looking at some way, and I cannot remember the phrase that was used, it's completely gone blank, but looking at some way of supporting people through particular provisions, immigration provisions to come into the sector. So that is written into our report. Yeah, thank you. Look, I think I'm out of time. So thank you so much. My contact details are there. Anybody who would like to contact me, I'm happy to chat about it further. Really appreciate your attention and appreciate these comments and thoughts. I think the next stage is, go for it. Okay, we've got to advocate for our position, our rightful position within the sector. So thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you so much, Sheila. And really groundbreaking work. I think it's the first time there's been any real comprehensive survey of the industrial relations framework, because we went, oh, it's complex. You know, we start off, oh, it's pretty complex, we know it's complex. But that systemic and methodical working through of all those agreements and actually saying this is what it looks like was really important. And certainly the capture of what had been, you know, captured in you know, slices and snapshots of the feelings of the sector, the thoughts of the sector, again, comprehensive capture of those thoughts and responses. And I can say that the interim report that Sheila and Macquarie Uni team did had a big impact on senior officers and ministers, because as soon as we had those lines of what was being found, we were able to advise upwards about this is, we know it's complex, this is the complexity. So we actually step out. And so the final report has been incredibly useful for senior officers and for in the governments around the country, as well as ministers, to get a bearing on exactly what the nature of the issue is. I think also too, it's important to note that the ACCC and the Productivity Commission also were able to read through Macquarie Uni's report, which is very useful. And I can see in some of their work, I can see aspects of Macquarie Uni's research. There's lines in there where I go, I know where that comes from. I can see that. So it has an impact, and will continue to have impact. So thank you so much, Sheila, for coming down and giving that presentation. I'd like to introduce our second guest speaker, Lisa McCoy. Lisa's the General Manager for National Projects in ASIQA. And Lisa's done a number of national projects and does them, you know, has them for breakfast, basically. She's one of the most, everybody wants to work with Lisa. She's one of the greatest leaders of national projects, and she's done some pretty big and significant changes to how we actually all work and how the law works and how we interact with a number of important sectors. So Lisa brings diverse experience to this role. She's worked in ECEC settings in Australia and London. She's been a senior executive in regulatory policy, legislation and program management roles in the Queensland Government and in the ASIQA. And as I said, she's extensive involvement and development implementation of the National Quality Agenda, particularly National Quality Framework Reviews, a range of things coming out of National Quality Framework Reviews, ensuring systemic quality improvement for us as a whole in our nation. So Lisa was leading in this work on child safety review last week, and she's going to present an overview of the final report on the review of child safety arrangements under the National Quality Framework. Please welcome Lisa.
Can everybody hear me at the back? Small, but great. Oh, thank you for that lovely welcome, Sean, as always. Lovely to be in Canberra, and it's just an absolute pleasure to be with you today, and thank you so much for the invite. In terms of, I'd just like to start by acknowledging traditional custodians of the land, the Ngunnawal people. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and I'd also like to acknowledge any First Nations colleagues who are with us in the room, and acknowledge all the lands. We're a national organisation, so I acknowledge all the lands across Australia. It's funny, I giggle when Sean said, where are you from? I do a bit of travel. It's like sometimes I've got to think where I am, but I am actually based in Brisbane, so I'm on Turrbal and Yagara country in Brisbane, but I do spend about a week a month, which is lovely, in our city office on Gadigal land. So it's lovely to travel around our beautiful country and also go out to some remote communities with the CCCFR project, which is lovely in Alice Springs and around Darwin and Adelaide. So absolutely lovely to be here with you this morning. Thank you for the introduction, Sean. It's my career, similarly to Professor Sheila, I'm a career early childhood person, so absolutely have loved it and have had the wonderful opportunity and privilege to be in this sector working in different roles. In terms of my projects, as Sean said, I have worked I've been with Asequa now approaching 5 years, which is just incredible. It goes so fast, I think, when you're doing the projects and things, but incredible opportunity and privilege to work on many different projects. I did the review of worked with our ACT colleagues in terms of another review, the review of the staffing qualification requirements under the National Workforce Strategy, which was great last year. And also, it's lovely, I just want to recognise, in the room we've also got, I also work with doing some national work with CCFR, community childcare funded restricted services around the nation, and also with in-home care, and just acknowledge we have got in-home care colleagues with us today. So it's just wonderful to have such a diverse group here today. It's wonderful to see not only NQF but broader. Now today I'm just going to cover off, as Sean said, provide a bit of background to the review and the report, and then pop into some findings and where things are at, hopefully to give you a good sense of not only what we found but also basis for recommendations. So I shall get started. Okay, now I just want to cover off a little bit of background for those who may not be as aware of the review, where it came from, etc., and why. So why a review? So Sean gave a beautiful overview in his introduction this morning, but basically it was around May last year. Was the federal minister commissioned, organised for the department to commission us to do the work. In terms of it, and it had come about because there had been some increased, very unfortunate critical incidents, often relating to transport and other things, but an increase in some critical incidents, and a timely opportunity really to have a strong focus on the children's safety aspects. While we had done many reviews, and Sean put up, we're still doing the implementation of the NQF reviews, which did have a strong focus on safety in terms of those. We hadn't sort of really had a strong over the, and I've been working within the NQF and informed the development of it and have been strongly involved, but we've never had a really strong lens looking just purely at that child safety aspect with that really strong focus on the more sort of pure child protection side. So very timely opportunity. The NQF, as you know, is needing to remain contemporary, so we need to make sure we keep up with all the latest and the research, etc. So we were originally commissioned by the two federal ministers in Department of Education to do the work. In terms of that, why did they choose us? Our functions were the CEQA, Australian Children's Education and Care Quality Authority, were established under the national law and were established and set up prior to the commencement of the National Quality Framework, and very much to support the administration and to support our state and territory colleagues in terms of the regulation of the sector, but also have many other functions we do under the legislation as well. So we're not the regulators, which often people get confused about. We're not the regulators, but support our colleagues in that function. And some of our functions very much are focused on making sure all our roles are done in terms of focused on the key sort of objectives and guiding principles in the legislation about ensuring children's health, safety and wellbeing is paramount, which everyone in this audience is very, very aware of. And equally, we provide advice. Another function is to provide advice to support the effective sort of administration to ensure it remains contemporary and reflects the evidence base in terms of the data that we keep through the NQIRTS. So given the critical importance of child safety, the other thing that happened as well was and I'm not sure it's mentioned in the report, but the Australian Child Maltreatment Study, which is called the ACMS, often with acronyms as we all love, was released and was quite alarming. It's really the first study that's been done on a larger scale, and it was in a broader society, not just obviously the early childhood education care sector, broader society, and basically found by the time children turn 18 that, and I'll make sure I've got my figures right, but two-thirds of children before the age of 18 experience one or more forms of abuse, and the abuse is not physical, sexual and emotional, and neglect has also been broadened to also cover exposure to domestic violence given the Obviously, the incidents have increased with that. So obviously, that was a key factor as well. That was quite alarming. And there's follow-up studies planned on that, actually, to do some more work. And the Australian government's working with that as well to sort of do further study, because it was so alarming in terms of that. As I said, our functions and strategic plan all align, and that's why we were approached to do the work, given our role we have in terms of supporting the sector to be sort of high quality and ensuring the safety and health and wellbeing of children. Now, I just want to cover off a little bit and go back and look at the review approach, because it's just in terms of explaining the findings and where we're at, it's really good to have that underpinning approach with that. So in terms of the objectives of the review, I must say too, with the review, I'll just say one thing before I do get into it, because it was terms of reference, and this is all part of the terms of reference were approved for the review. When the review commenced in May, shortly after around 1st of August, you'd be very aware of Operation Tenterfield was announced. So the terms of reference that we had, which I'll explain and I covered off in this slide, we stuck to those terms of reference, didn't broaden the scope, which I'll explain, or change it. So the report that we produced doesn't go into obviously any facts or anything to do with that case. That case is still obviously working its way through. It highlighted, I suppose, the urgency for the work, but it certainly didn't go into any of the facts around the case. And that's something, as I go through some of the recs, we linked in closely with some work there with the Australian Federal Police. So, but I will get to that in a moment. First and foremost, when we commenced, there were agreed tours. It was a desktop review only, so it's key to note just in terms of who we were able to consult with as part of it. We were requested to do a desktop review only. I think some of the main reasons were there's a plethora of, and we've Sean went through a lot, there was a plethora of reviews underway to do with ACCC, PEC, strategy, visions, a whole range of different things underway. This started as a desktop review just to look through and run our eye over and link with some experts, which I'll go into, but started out as that to enable, I suppose, for us to provide a report that then can be further consulted on, which I'll talk about in a moment. So in terms of our scope of the review and the objectives, so it was to look at really the child safety arrangements within the NQF, but also those that interact with the National Quality Framework, which links to the many different pieces of wide range of legislation that's state and territory specific, and also looking at the intersections with those. It includes things working with children checks or vulnerable checks here in ACT, teachers' registration, and congratulations on today. That's very timely, the work that's being done in Teacher Reg, which I'll get to in a moment. And looking at reportable conduct schemes where jurisdictions have them, and also where embedded, sort of the child safety principles have been embedded in state legislation. So it's looking at all those as well. So in terms of, and the strong focus was generally on child safety, there was a particular focus on reducing harm, abuse and neglect, obviously because of the reasons that I've mentioned. In terms of how we structured the report, it was very much structured around and you'll be very aware of the child safe environment policy and the obligations that approved providers are required to meet. And there's a policy that's required on that, and it covers those three aspects. And there's three chapters in the report that focus on the physical and also the online environment, which I'll get to as we go through it, staffing and supervision and the child protection in arrangements or requirements, which are very much that pure sort of child protection aspect around covering off reporting of physical and sexual abuse and other aspects. We had to look at the broader, the provisions and how they interact and are supported by those child safety and protection network arrangements, the broad arrangements in state and territory, look at contemporary best practice and international standards and research, and look at any gaps. So it's very much a desktop to identify any gaps where any strengthening could occur. Targeted consultation only, given it was desktop, so we had the wonderful opportunity to link with eSafety Commissioner Department of Social Services, who have been rolling out a number of strategies linked to different national child protection strategies that have been released since the release of the Royal Commission report on physical and sexual abuse in institutions. We also had the wonderful opportunity to link in the Attorney General's office with the National Office of Child Safety, which was wonderful. And that was the main ones. And the other key one that we linked with our other experts really as part of it were, of course, the regulatory authorities who bring so much wealth of knowledge in terms of the current provisions and how they're working and practice. The Australian government also, and some of your, from a national perspective, might be linked into it, also hold a quarterly early childhood education reference group. So we were able to, which was wonderful, attend on a couple of occasions just to road test or just to get a bit of a sense of some of the recs as well, just to say, oh, look, we're thinking about this. And that was just a wonderful opportunity because that group covers all sectors as well, which is great, and all service types, which is another aspect in terms of covering, as we know, service types, different service types and delivery models are incredibly important, so understanding the different contexts. Okay, now in terms of the, I just want to touch on briefly in terms of the research that we undertook, the report has well over 100 pages and we did the, obviously, executive summary to try and condense and have that in the front to make it easy to engage in. But we certainly, there's a lot more tables that were sitting behind it, supplementary, that were sort of not included to help support in the mapping and research that we did. In terms of research, it was wonderful to look at other countries and look at where sort of extremely sort of from a child protection perspective, sort of any there weren't countries from that lens who were sort of ahead of us. There were elements in some aspects where the OECD, for example, was wonderful in terms of they continue to highly recognise the work being done by the eSafety Commission, and that commissioner was set up in response to the Royal Commission work, and they were incredibly favourable about that. Other aspects that we picked up when we were doing that research were a couple of countries who are leading their field. There's an intersection with the online focus on around CCTV, and Israel is a country that is probably the most advanced around that, and it's referred to in the report on the work they've done around early childhood in terms of that. There's and some other work that's been done in England about really enshrining and following through about in terms of decision making, like making sure that trying to remove any barriers legislatively to ensure, I suppose, children's interest at the heart of decision making. So completely the concepts we have in the national law about children being at the heart of that and trying to make decisions that are in their best interest, particularly when in the England case where they've got working with multiple agencies, etc., trying to make sure that information is shared, etc., to enable the appropriate response. And they've had that in place since about 2017. We also took into account that we've had quite a few Royal Commissions happening while we were doing it, as well as those other pieces that Sean referred to and Professor Sheila referred to them as well. We've had Royal Commission, we had the South Australian Royal Commission that was looking at their early childhood and sort of rolling out universal access that covered off some aspects. And we equally had one, which is very timely, was the Tasmanian Royal Commission, which supported actually a lot of our findings as well. The Royal Commission findings came out, I think it was about October last year, and that was great to have a read of as well. And equally, there's been different reviews happening in the disability and NGO space. So we tried to keep across, most of them were running in parallel, but tried to keep across a lot of that while we were doing the report. In terms of governance, the governance aspects, we tried to use existing mechanisms that we had to feed into that. So a lot of whilst the federal ministers had initially commissioned the review, and you would have seen through all the education ministers come together around the country, and they were all extremely supportive of it and were part of it and are being kept abreast of it in terms of that. And I'll go into some of that with the findings. But it was very much about using the existing structures that we had, which is we saw as the most easiest way to work in a very complex report that was needing to be done quite quickly. And obviously, because of the focus, the media focus, and a lot that happened with Operation Tenterfield, gained a lot more prominence as we were wearing on, as we continued on, it was much more heightened. So using existing structures, which we needed to do as well because we needed to work with our colleagues in the with regulatory authorities and the states and governments in that area to do what we needed to. As in terms of that, so governance-wise, we stuck with that in terms, and it was a desktop review. So they're probably the main things I just wanted to cover off because it's key to where the report and the recommendations and what sort of happens next. Now, in terms of the overview, and Sean covered on this, most importantly, the main thing we picked up, obviously, was that ENQF is a internationally recognised. I often hear my CEO, Gabrielle Sinclair, say, and it's completely true, that where we've been so lucky in this country, we've focused on quality first, and now we're sort of very strongly focused on access. Other countries have done it the other way around, and I think the review strongly highlighted that we have got such a very, very robust, internationally recognised system with the great work since 2012 to amalgamate all state and territory legislation, and equally have a quality standard benchmark. So, and very much having children's best interest at the heart, in terms of their safety, health and well-being, and focused on equally on continuous quality improvement, which is a key underlying principle in the legislation. The report makes 16 recommendations, which are very much focused on that intent of children, placing children, their safety rights and best interests at the heart of early childhood education and care in terms of that. And in doing so and the work that's happened, and you would have seen it in some of the communiques that come out, that obviously all governments acknowledge that overwhelmingly the majority of approved providers and staff are, as we've just heard from the wonderful presentation, are very, you know, skilled, dedicated professionals, like many of you in the room, and I've been doing my life, devoting their life to the industry. So it's a completely acknowledging that and acknowledging the context too of that was another thing that's highlighted in the report, linking to that point too, is acknowledging the workforce challenges as well, going through and watching that and being in awe of the sector through COVID and grappling with that and the fallouts of COVID, which have impacted in terms of attraction, retention, and service capacity and things about staff services and things. And to acknowledge as well that it does sit in a broader, the NQF does exist in that broader landscape. So whilst we do have the NQF, the NQF has been set up to link with so many things, for example, such as you're working with vulnerable children, people, checks, etc. So there's much broader things that happen and interrelate. So in terms of the recommendations, there's 16 recommendations that are in review and they've responded to some of the key findings, some of the key findings mainly through, given we couldn't consult heavily, mainly through regulatory authorities, and they are listed in the executive summary. The things such as reported increase in sort of incidents and allegations, increase in the use of things like inappropriate discipline, absence of sort of a coherent national frame for where we wanted to enabling really regulators to monitor persons of interest who fall sort of probably don't quite meet thresholds of either criminal activity or those in the legislation for compliance, but there is patterns of behaviour that are concerning if they're together, collected and easily accessed and enabled and shared confidentially. And also in some cases, picking up the difficulties in understanding, particularly with sometimes within jurisdictions, but across jurisdictions, understanding with the broader responsibilities that service have, and there's lots of different responsibilities outside the NQF for reporting, et cetera, but particularly for those approved providers and services that operate across, and there's a lot of approved providers increasingly that do operate across jurisdictions, understanding the very complex thresholds, the thresholds around those reporting requirements. So they're the sort of things, and it identified basically recommendations to strengthen national approaches for child-safe cultures. It's about safer online environments, more effective information sharing systems and building workforce knowledge and capabilities were sort of some of the the high level focus in terms of that. So the report went and I remember the date. It was released on obviously 21st of December, but had gone to ministers prior to that. The report was released. Minister considered the report, and there were 16 recommendations. There were those that were in their remit, which I'll go through shortly, in the remit of ministers and the education portfolios, and there were some that were outside of that as well, which I'll talk about. So the ministers considered that just in the lead up to prior to it being released on the 21st of December, and they asked basically states and territories to do some work in terms of looking at implementation. So the key themes are the ones I've covered off. So the key themes are those, which I've already covered off. So we'll go over to the next slides. Now, I thought I would just touch on in terms of the recommendations, I thought I'd just highlight, we don't have enough time to take you through, it's a 100-page report, it's 16 recommendations, but I just wanted to highlight a few of the recommendations within that, and then I will cover off as well in terms of next steps on where everything is at. But I did want to cover off a few of them for you in terms of that. The report focused on, with the first 12 recommendations, are focused within the NQF, and I'll take you through a couple of slides of those and pick up and highlight a couple of those where we will go into detail. But it focused on changes, firstly, to the National Quality Standard. So that was around in terms of trying to reflect in the first couple of recommendations around that. And that was just trying to reflect the importance in Quality Area 7, for example, in the National Quality Standard, the importance of ensuring in terms of governance, the approved providers and the governance and leadership and management, that it's picked up in that quality area, child safe cultures is picked up in that. So it was just really recognising the importance of that. The other aspect, which is was the second rec in that 1.2, was very much around physical and online, covering the fact of, at the moment, our national quality standard is around physical. And as everybody knows, we've had a huge, and that was one of the main things that came up and it was included in the media at the time of doing the report, online technologies is something from a contemporary point of view that really is an evolving space for everyone. Everyone at the moment is talking about artificial intelligence. It's mentioned in the report just as an evolving space, but it's something that online that has increased hugely since I remember doing when we worked on the National Quality Framework, developing it years ago. And we certainly did some changes in the NQF review that have been still a couple more to go, but have been implemented, and that's been covering off, you know, more about keeping policies about online. But this was about picking it up in terms of not only do we have a physical environment, sort of that hard environments around us, but we do have the online environments now. So that's what the 1.2 is about, very much about that, and looking to pick that up in terms of physical and online, about quality area 3, but also equally quality area 2 when we talk about children's safety, you know, making sure there's alignment through the changes we made to the regulation and policies through the NQF review, making sure there's alignment through the NQS as well, because if we know they're all linked together. So I'll just pick up a highlight a few. Recommendation 2 was around to do with supervision. Supervision was one of the key aspects in terms of the work we looked at, and protective, I suppose, factors. Supervision is key. So we looked at things, and there's a couple of recs there that relate to, or a few recs through that link to supervision. And the ones in terms of 2.1, we looked at removing the ability to apply for a waiver. At the moment, you can apply for a waiver around the ability to be able to supervise, which is around the design, and there's a very small number. There's only 10 waivers in place, but we looked at, you know, and suggested that should be a recommendation about removing that ability, unless it's very exceptional circumstances that can be sort of demonstrated it's still safe. The other one that came up was 2.2, that we did a lot of work, and ACT's been involved in it with the National Construction Code, and those changes were made last year, and you've still got some more to come through for ACT. But we did a lot of work around multi-storey, and which was great, and achieved those changes to the National Construction Code to better support services in multi-storey and how what safety requirements need to be in place. This one is about 2.2 is about, again, working with the Australian Building Codes Board to look at if in terms of any changes need to be made to the National Construction Code in terms of the built environment around being able to effectively supervise. So that's one of the recs that's there to follow on really from the multi-storey work that we have done through the National Quality Framework Review. The next few, 2.3 down to about 2.6 that are listed, were very much, and these ones got a lot of media attention, and these ones were very much about service devices. First and foremost, that services, center-based services should only be using service-issued devices, not their own personal phones, to protect staff, and in terms of the where the information, you know, photos or whatever else is being taken, whether it's videos or images, to ensure that it's stored correctly, has appropriate consent, stored correctly, just given the, obviously online and the potential for it to be misused online in terms of that, and also recommended that it should prohibit the use while working with children, not having them on site, of course, but while working directly with children in centre-based services, that the phones should be not on the body as such. And we also linked that through in the report and picked up the fact that, that it was interesting listening for Professor Sheila's and the discussion around that, around in terms of expectations, and picks up the expectation of a lot of sometimes parental expectation or whatever around wanting to see constant photos and things like that taken. So which can be, in terms of distraction around, obviously around supervision, the report picks up on those aspects. That there's a strong focus on this and reporting back. Also picks up and looks on, talks about CCTV and talks about the research there and making sure that there's also appropriate procedures and parents are advised around CCTV, et cetera. It's an incredibly useful tool when regulatory authorities need to, if they've got some investigations that need to take place, but incredibly useful, but just in terms of how it's used. And a lot of the research show that doesn't always, stop behaviours. People sort of tend to forget or whatever, doesn't always stop behaviours. And I've seen it on CCTV, captures behaviours that do take place. So it's a mechanism that may not completely prevent but can be useful but needs to be used appropriately. In terms of the next set around the recommendations for are very much around some regulation changes that were in terms of, aligning timeframes for reporting. It's quite complex in the regulation about reporting. In terms of there's so many different things you have to report, and they're different timeframes. And in terms of reporting things like that can come through, like physical and sexual abuse, it just depends. Some could take seven, some are required to be 7 days if they're received under the provisions of reporting physical and sexual abuse. If it comes in and meets the threshold of a serious incident, it's 24 hours, and complaints can be 24 hours. So it was around trying to just, the rationalisation behind that is trying to align those timeframes in terms of that. So it's very clear if it's around physical or sexual abuse, it's the 24 hours rather than 7 days. There was a bit of tidying up around family daycare that started with the we started with the NQF review, but just making it very clear around the areas that children may access a residence versus a place, doing some tidy up there to make sure, just to cover off any, ensuring that appropriate providers and enabling also authorised officers to be able to access those other places if needed as well. There's one that was very interesting, and every day I read more on this coming down, I read more about it. Was including the e-cigarettes, vaping. There's constant, and we linked with the health area for advice, but certainly with the vaping, it's not picked up really in the smoking because it's a vapor and often chemicals and usually not a sort of a nicotine-type base as per smoking. So we wanted to pick that one up as an evolving an evolving one that has certainly greatly increased, and the reports coming out, evidence-based research starting to come out about it, is certainly very harmful. So that was quite a key one to pick up. So that's sort of a bit of an overview of those recommendations. The next set was very much to do with recommendation 9, completely focused on looking through the legislation and looking at the working with children check / the vulnerable children checks, looking through the legislation and looking at that, and provided some recommendations about how to align with some of that about who's required to report changes in, if they've had a change to that. And it's a little bit about making sure information is shared there and ensuring that obviously everyone around children is fit and proper. It did have the caveat on it, though, that it needs to be, because all, this is where it got very complex, all jurisdictions are different around that. So this, not all jurisdictions would need to have probably the level of, may not need all the provisions, because it shouldn't duplicate if your jurisdiction is already making sure that that information is being shared across and required to be disclosed by the person to the service, that it didn't mean that it would duplicate. So the whole intent was highlighting where it can be increased, where there were gaps, and strengthening. There's a couple of provisions there around to support sort of pre-service vetting and safeguarding, and that's just looking at the, as mentioned, about inappropriate discipline, whether it was strongly that provision, and also looking about whether some exploring inappropriate interactions and whether there should be some elevate that to put it in the national law, because it was very clear talking to regulatory authorities, there's some behaviours that don't fit the inappropriate discipline because there wasn't an intent to discipline. So looking at that in terms of the inappropriate interactions to provide a mechanism to have an offence attached to that. The other one I just want to pick up on is recommendation 12. That was put in around child protection training, and that one was really interesting because when you look at that, was put in last NQF review that was released in 2017 and commenced then. And the legislation is a bit circular, and it requires basically for the child protection side and who's required to, and it limits the people in the legislation who are required to be trained. But it's circular and says only if it's required in your jurisdiction. And looking at when we looked at all the jurisdictions, it could be through a different statutory instrument or a protocol. There wasn't a lot in terms of requiring that. There weren't many jurisdictions that had that in place. So it was really just highlighting the fact that that's in the legislation currently the way it was. So it was recommending that it should be required, and who should be required to do that, and basically anyone who comes into contact with children, and also covered off the scope of training that should be required to cover off everything to support, you know, educators and those working with children to be able to identify, respond, and know what to do in terms of reporting. Understand grooming was a key one that comes up again and again, the grooming, because grooming, all the research and history is around grooming, of starting with adults and then obviously moving to children. So very key for the whole, those working with children to understand that. Rep 16 was included, and it's probably, we talk about it as probably one of the most important ones, because it says basically, talks about 2 years depending on how long implementation takes, but coming back, and this was done in discussions with the Australian Federal Police, whilst I couldn't disclose much, you know, obviously much at all, because it's a case that's going through courts with Operation Tenorfield, but it's very much, as more does come out over time, which will take time, it is going back and looking at everything just to make sure, is there anything else that needs to happen? So it's, we talk about that as one of the key ones. I'm going for time, Kylie.
Yeah.
There's a few additional safeguards, which I'll just touch on, that were in the report from Recs 6 to 8. These are within ministers' portfolios, but not the NQF. And they include the first one is the registration one, and it was fantastic to hear we've got 4 jurisdictions and ACT is leading the way, their work under the National Workforce Strategy, and move to in terms of the registration and enabling all teachers to register, basically. That's what that one's about. We went further than the National Workforce Strategy and said, and work was progressing already on the mandatory, on voluntary registration, but and the recommendation is around requiring teachers, early childhood teachers, to be registered similarly in schools because of the benefits of, that that provides. It's around around the vetting and sharing, particularly the sharing of information that occurs and requirements and onus that places on both the sort of the regulatory authorities, but equally the those that are registered. So just in terms of the additional checks and balances that are done about disciplinary actions and things, and additional registration, additional checks and balances in that system. Linked to it, Rec 7, there's work underway, and it has been going on for quite a few years around automatic mutual recognition, whereby someone could move around the country and basically teacher registration have their registration recognised. There's work in New South Wales happening at the moment, and we strongly urge for that to continue to enable that to happen, the automatic mutual recognition. But first of all, they need to look at the child safety aspects, and that's what they're doing to try and make sure. So if you've taken on a teacher from another jurisdiction, the appropriate checks and balances have been done in the initial jurisdiction where they were registered. The last one is exciting, and that's around the Australian Professional Standards for teachers. And one teacher, one profession. I remember meeting the panel years ago on that one, and it's been around for years. The sector clearly told everyone that they wanted, you know, the standards to recognise early childhood. So that's one we included because we thought that was incredibly important in terms of professionalism and supporting the registration. It also enables, in terms of the professional standards, the links and getting that right, it supports the move from professional, from provisional to full registration, and also links to some of the changes that have previously been happening around wages and being recognised in terms of stages and that. So that's why we strongly included that one in terms of career stages and recognising that one. So it's great to see that they're continuing through the workforce strategy. The last set I'll just briefly touch on. So we met with the Federal Attorney Generals met last year, 23rd of November. My CEO and I were able to attend that and brief them on the report where we're at. This is the broader work in terms of all Attorney Generals around the country, really following on and working with from the Royal Commission work and the report on institutional abuse. Many of the recs that are there are already underway, but are needing to, they're at different stages and needing to be progressed. So basically all the education ministers have written across to the Federal Attorney General just to really support and highlight the fact we need that to keep moving for the broader changes to be looked at in terms of that. And that's very much about, embedding where it's not embedded around the country, around the child safe principles. It's around the whole working with children checks and looking at maybe some mandatory requirements linked to anybody who needs to get a working with children check, information sharing, consistent processes that the whole country is different. The table at the back covers that in terms of thresholds, what age you apply, who it covers, whole range of different things to do with the working with children checks. Thresholds for reportable conduct, where states and territories have them, other states don't. Mandatory reporting-wise, again, everyone's different in terms of who they've got to report on. For example, WA, it's only sexual, where there's sexual abuse. It's all different for across the country, so recommended that. 15 sort of four onwards, very much focused on central points for referrals, which is already underway through the Department of Social Services work with the linking with Attorney Generals, and some consistency around some sort of reporting activities, and also links with 15.6 is a really big rec in the report, and that's about linking agencies, links between agencies, and trying to get sort of continuous monitoring, which is some work underway through Attorney Generals, continuing monitoring with the working at children checks at a national level. So all those things linking together. Now I'm going to quickly pop over to the implementation And you'll get copies of these slides as well after it, and some of the, so if you didn't see the finer details, it's up there. So in terms of implementation, basically, which is great, ministers have met, in principle agree with, and that was released in the communique, in principles agree with the recommendations, noting some further work for some of them needs to take place. And that's around doing, obviously we didn't have the luxury, which would have been lovely, of consulting more broadly. So some consulting to happen for some, for quite a few of the pieces. There will be consultation, regulation impact statements and to happen with that. Similarly with what previous NQF reviews have done, there'll need to be a focus on that just to look at costs and benefits and analysis with that. And there'll also be a focus as well on continuing to engage experts, which are incredibly important, obviously, in terms of continuing to link with the NOCs, the National Office, the Safety Commissioner, the policing elements in terms of that side, but making sure that anything that, and there's different complex elements to it all, but expert guidance is taken into account as the information is developed for consultation, for like a series process. There's things that can be done, and ministers wanted things to be done. There's things that don't require, that are a lot easier to do because they're not changes to the national law. They may not require a change to the like national quality standard, for example. So that they're looking at things like guidance around, one of the recs was around developing some sort of voluntary guidance about service issue devices. So that some work is underway at the moment, and there's also some regulation changes that are much easier to do. For example, some can include the vaping and just changes in timeframes, which are less impact and not requiring as much C-RIS, D-RIS work. So basically states and territories are working together on that. We've got Australian Government and the Queensland leading that, and CEQA is working and supporting that work. The state at the moment and the briefing, continuing to brief ministers, are getting regular updates, and that work will start rolling out soon with and the sector will be consulted sort of once that gets to that C-RIS and D-RIS stage. But at the moment, states and territories, a huge amount of regs, whether it's within the NQF or outside of it, for those in the NQF, states and territories are working through who does what pieces and how that is done to try and sort of expedite where possible those that can be progressed earlier. For the outside pieces, ministers, EMM ministers, have written to the Department of Industry about the National Construction Code to highlight that and draw their attention to the regs that they're wanting to work on that one. So that has also taken place for in terms of that, and also to the Attorney General as well around the recommendations that are sort of that 12 to 15, sorry, 13 to 15, which focus on the broader work they're doing as part of the Attorney General's work, just to highlight and sort of try and escalate that work, given the strong connections it has with setting up sort of that outside, all the interacting pieces that come into the NQF. So that's where it's at. So there'll be sort of more to flow out once governments have sort of worked out the implementation, and a lot more consultation to happen just to work out pragmatically how that occurred, you know, pragmatically how the recommendations will work in practice in terms of it, to make sure that they're fit for purpose and will work in practice. A key point of that I want to mention too that's happening is just work around with state in particular to seek their advice on how to consult and work with First Nations services, just to ensure, and the report picks up on it, that anything's done in terms of training or anything else has to be culturally appropriate as well. So that work has been and started with briefings prior to the report being released. They're part of the Early Childhood Education Reference Group and have been consulted along the way in terms of ensuring that that it's appropriately done, that consultation and the context are taken into account in terms of all aspects of the recommendations. So it will be for not only the thinking through about implementation, but also the implementation and how that's done. But basically that's where it's at. RECs in principle support, but a lot to happen and a lot to be communicated and having Sean and with states and territories involved. Sean is our head of our regulatory practice committee, which is CEQA convenes, where all regulatory authorities come together, and the regulatory practice committee is certainly looking at a couple of aspects of that, particularly to do with the NQRTS and how we share information on that to make sure that at the moment what might be in confidential fields or other things can be shared appropriately with the right protections to make sure that any patterns or whatever can be observed. So a lot more to come, but just a little, I just wanted to give you a little bit of thinking behind the recs and to let you know that there's certainly an opportunity to feed in terms of pragmatically through the CRIS process and the consultation that will occur through there, very much an opportunity to influence that in terms of how that's implemented. But that's probably the main bits I wanted to say. And obviously any questions, importantly. A lot to take in there, and can understand if there's not, and always I'll stick around at the end if there's any, if you do have any questions, more than happy to answer those. A lot to take in, but there's a lot more to come as well. We're just at the stage of government's working out implementation, so a lot more to come, but please don't hesitate. If you think of a question after, please feed them through Claire and Sean and Kylie and the team. Very happy to answer any questions that do come up with it. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa. Much appreciated. And also, it's a good time to acknowledge the authorised officers who undertake investigations in regulatory authorities around the country. It's hard work and it's consistently negative work. So, and through them, we have a greater protection for all the children that we engage with. I'd like now to introduce our next guest speaker, Marshall Pečić, who's the Chief Executive Officer and founder of In Safe Hands. Michael's got over 30 years' experience in child protection and case management, investigation, education, and Michael's team offers practical experience and expertise in education, law, psychology, and offers insights into child-safe governance, leadership, and culture. Please welcome Michael.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. I guess if I just have something to say about the last presentation, there is one gap that I think that we definitely need to have a look at, and that's around our interdepartmental investigation of child protection issues. Currently across all states, whenever there's an issue of a child that's at risk and the Department of Child Safety or Department of Communities is investigating it, we see that if the child's at school, that the education department can contact the school and provide regular updates of the child's education practices, what's happening at the school all the time. But when the child attends early childhood education, there is no ability for information to travel regularly from the early childhood setting to the investigators unless the Department of Child Safety Officer actually rings the service and asks them lots of questions. We know that they don't do that because there's that concern around confidentiality. So what we see is you, early years educators, being left in the dark. We don't know what's happening when a child's being reported to the Department of Child Safety. And so we really need to make sure that we create some stability around that for early years educators. And the other reason is obviously Section 167 of the Education and Care Services National Law Act says that you have to take all reasonable precautions to protect children from harm in your service. Well, if we don't know, if we report a child's at risk, part of our reasonable precaution to protect the child is that we need to know what the government's response is to that so we can support the child. We can't do that if we're left in the dark all the time. So that would be definitely something that I think that moving forward, it's definitely something that the government should look at. So anyway, I'll get on to my point now. Alrighty, so I'm going to not talk about legislation. Where all this information that I'm going to provide you from, obviously In Safe Hands, for a lot of you may have heard of us, we do a lot of training. But perhaps the other arm that you don't know we're aware of, I lead a large team of investigators. We do a lot of investigations in the early childhood setting around reportable conduct scheme investigations, all of those sort of minor incidences that happen at within centres where parents make complaints, and we come in and as a transparent investigation for the nominated supervisors or for the owners to make sure that there's some sort of process put into place that we can, if we identify some problem, then we can fix that problem. And so that's where I'm coming from today, for you to understand what are the real weak points that we're seeing in early childhood when it comes to child safety. And hopefully I can give you some strategies on how we can support staff and educators about how we make sure that we really understand what we're doing when we're talking about child safety and protection. So the first thing that I want you to understand is that in our professional worlds, we have two types of subconscious behaviours. Firstly, we have our personal subconscious behaviour, and then what we need educators to make sure that they do have is a professional subconscious behaviour. Now, it's really important that we understand that we're all adults, so majority of our subconscious behaviours have been embedded in us for such a long time that it takes incredible change for us to be able to change opinions. We talk about that most adults take 6 months to change a subconscious behaviour to another one. That's why most people fail dieting, exercising, giving up alcohol, all of those sort of things, because it has to be a conscious decision for such a long time. The biggest downfall that we see in all our investigations is the breakdown in communication within services. And that happens because simply it's a human trait that when we work with somebody a lot, we get to know what they do well, they understand what I do well, they know what they do, I do, we just get the job done and we forget to communicate about it. So it's really, really important that we understand that, and we all need to understand that we all hear and see things differently. So we're going to play a game now. So for that, I actually need you guys to talk for once, okay? So, and for it to work, I need everybody to do it in a really loud voice. Pretty simple. I'm going to put a colour up on the board. As soon as you see the colour, yell out what colour you see. Pretty simple. Don't think about it. As soon as you see the colour, yell it out. You ready? One, two, three, go. So usually when I play this game, I get three answers. I get white, red, or green. Did anybody say white? That's good, because usually I just say you're being difficult. We move on, so I don't have to say that to anybody. If you said red, basically your brain has conditioned you to read first no matter what. Doesn't matter what the question was. As soon as a word pops up, you will read. If you saw green, you would do exactly the opposite. You see color and shape before you see a word. That's why really important things in our world are all three things where we have to make quick decisions around. Stop signs, give way signs are a word, color and shape to combat the way we interpret and see things. And when we talk about children, it's really, really important that our educators are not making assumptions. And that's what our subconscious behavior does. It makes those assumptions. So if we see a child do something or say something in front of us, your brain immediately applies your professional subconscious to it. And you go, I've seen that before. I'm not worried about that. I am worried about that. We need to make sure that educators understand we don't want them making assumptions. They need to clarify that. And clarification comes by engaging with the child and, most importantly, engaging with our supervisors. And it has to be done then, not later. It needs to be making sure that we're dealing that as something that we're communicating with all the time. So that's the first thing, that it's really important that we all understand that. The second thing, is that we need to know how we actually build a capacity about making a response or making a difference. Traditionally, what we've seen in just about every type of environment is that we've always seen policies, risk management, and training provided to educators. And it's not just about this industry, it's about all industries. But we need to acknowledge that child safety and protection is an extremely complex topic. It's something that those three things alone will not provide the educators the knowledge and the support they need to make decisions. And so what they need is to understand their capacity to be able to support, understanding how to evolve to undertake environmental scans. So what we mean by that, so if I give you a few examples around that. So when we talk about trust, courage, and resilience, it's really important that that's about our workplace health and safety. It's all about us understanding that we've seen significant changes in that space where we now hear about the terms respect at work, psychosocial hazards. But the reality is that there needs to be a shift in early childhood education for us to understand what that means. Far too often I've seen educators charged with assault, losing their Working with Children card because of concerns around active supervision. And all of those things happen because of one important thing that usually that educator fails to disclose, and that's they're under stress. All right. Now, I'm not going to stereotype, and I'm not being sexist, and I'm not talking for all men in this room, but usually when a man has a man flu, everybody knows about it. All right. But what we can tell you about, and I'm not stereotyping lay women either, but what we usually see with women is that you can pull up at your workplace and it doesn't matter if you've been up all night with the children. It doesn't matter if you've got things going on in your personal life that are stressing you and you're not sleeping well. The first thing I see is that you hop out of the car, you take a big breath and you walk into that service like nothing's wrong. And then it usually takes somebody at lunchtime to pull you aside and go, what's wrong? You're not yourself. And then we see them, oh, the editor comes. All right. It's really, really important that we understand that you're in one of the most stressful occupations in the world. They say don't work with children and animals. So, and your job's on is job's on for you. You can't just walk away and make yourself a cup of coffee. You can't go talk to people, send emails. So it's really, really important that you need to make your team needs to know they can make themselves a little bit vulnerable. They need to be able to come in and say, listen, I'm tired today. I'm stressed today. It doesn't mean that we can allow them to go sleep in the staff room for 3 hours. It just means that we now know that if I'm working with that educator in the room, that I'm going to make them laugh a little bit more today. I'm going to check in with them a little bit more. I'm not going to allow them to deal with a difficult child on and on again, even though I normally know they deal with it really, really well. It's about us making sure that we have systems and processes in place, that we're creating a culture of resilience and being able to protect children. All right, so it's important that we strategize around that. When we're talking about support, it's really important that we understand that we give clear processes to staff. So I've already mentioned that section 167 where it talks that we need to take all reasonable precautions to protect children from harm. Whenever I do an investigation, what I see is that the services have fantastic notes of the incident, what happened, what they did afterwards, but then it just stops. Reasonable precaution of protecting children from harm, it needs us to understand that if we know a child is at risk because of something that happened at home, we need to be checking in on that child for the next couple of weeks, depending on what it is. So we need to have a plan around that. And so what normally happens when I come and investigate, I'll ask the director or the manager, what's your plan around that? And they'll verbally tell me something. But then when I interview other staff, that verbalisation changes to different things because all staff or educators don't say the same thing. And then it looks like there's holes. So just remember that when we're doing our notes, and I've written to the CEQA just asking them in their reporting forms and all of that to have a section there where they have, what's our safety plan moving forward for that child. Okay, because if we have that, then it's written, then everybody knows about it, we can share about it. So it's about us, how do we support educators in knowing how we discharge our duty of care around children is really, really important. Environmental scans. It's all about us knowing our families and knowing what's triggering that, but it's more importantly that we know our staff and what's triggering them as well. If we know that we've got staff that are... our educators are, we're down on numbers, we're struggling, we've got people doing a lot of extra stuff for us. We need to make sure that we're doing environmental scans to find out in the short term, how do we support them? Because if we don't support them, that's when they start missing things. That's when they might do something that shortcuts something and then we see complaints made about them. So it's really, really important that we strategize around that. And also about environmental scans, we've seen a huge shift in the words active supervision, and that's because they've introduced the word active, and we want educators really working with children. What we're actually seeing is educators not allowing children to solve problems, they're solving it for them. So because they're in with the child all the time and they're with the group, if something happens, the educators are solving the problem, We need educators to make sure that, yes, sometimes we need to solve the problem, but if it's happened once, it's most likely going to happen again. So we need to come up with ways that children can self-regulate in those sort of processes. And it's really important that we strategize on how to do that. And I'll give you some examples later when we get to children. All right. So some of the things that we need to understand that when we're supporting staff is around targeting descriptive walls. So when we talk about descriptive walls, it's all about us understanding that technology is a wonderful thing, but what it also does, it makes it very difficult sometimes for educators to understand how we engage families and parents. You know, we've seen processes around the introduction of apps being used a lot in services, but we need to find some balance around the apps. Okay, I'm seeing far too many things where educators are feeling stressed that they've got to take photos of children every 5 seconds and putting them online. They've got to put information up there all the time for families. It's really important that we understand that the National Quality Framework is about preparing children for life and their families. The next step in life is school. We know schools do not provide information to parents every 5 minutes about what their child's doing. Okay, so it's important that staff need to be supported in ways that they can provide children a safe environment by connecting with them all the time and not looking for those extracurricular things that they have to do to appease the needs of a small amount of parents that want it all the time. It's also about our ability to understand that educators need to be able to communicate with parents in various ways. All right, otherwise we miss things. So one of the biggest things that I see services getting themselves in a twist about and complaints being made is that we see parents coming in and they're saying to services they want, my child's only allowed 15 minutes, 25 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, 10 minutes sleep. Where do parents get that number from? I'm still to find a parent that actually tells me that. All right. It's really, really important that we understand that sometimes what we do, we create those problems for us within our services. So the reality is that majority of services that are using apps now are just putting in the information on there about how long a child's sleeping for and how much they ate. Now, if I can wind back the clock many, many moons ago when my children were going to early childhood, that was always written on a book where you went into the front room and you could see if they're available. And actually, one of the educators that one of my sons went to, she always had it on her. So she never had it just sitting somewhere. She had the list with her. So when parents come in, they had to ask. Because for me, I was lucky. I had 3 kids go through early childhood and that I never once looked at that book, nor did I look at how much they ate or whether they slept. And no, it wasn't just me because I was a dad. My wife didn't either. All right. But the reality is that we were lucky. We had 3 kids that slept and ate. The parents that want to know that information all the time are usually struggling with something at home. And we're missing that opportunity to engage with parents by just constantly just giving them everything. Right? We need parents to come in and ask, you know, did my child sleep today? How long did they sleep for? Well, my question straight back is, how are they sleeping at home? Because I know that's the reason why they're asking that. But we're missing those opportunities to support families when we have the opportunity to. And I guess some of the child safe recommendations is all around having early intervention and prevention strategies. And that's a clear one, because if we don't get that, then that causes issues where parents perceive that, you know, we're telling them what to do and how to do things. And what it's doing is causing stress for educators. And when educators are stressed, just like parents, your tolerance levels around children shrink and we say and do things that are silly, and we don't want to see that in our environment. So it's about us strategizing around how we engage with families, and more importantly, that we need to do it in a timely manner when it's supporting them, not when it's already finished. So does that make sense to everybody? Okay. When we talk about creating that respectful based platform for services to operate with their staff, it's really important that we understand the complexities around child safety. So we know that we talk to staff about, we give them indicators around physical harm, sexual harm, neglect, emotional abuse. So if I just ask you guys a question and get you to So the question is, are parents allowed to smack their children in the ACT? If you think they're not allowed to, can you raise your hand? If you think they are, raise your hand. Who here has no idea? Now, fundamentally, if we're going to provide educators with tools around when they have a concern around something on a child, if we don't know what the rules are around that, how are we expecting an educator to make those decisions and be able to come forward? The dangers are, what do they apply? They apply their own thoughts, their cultural or religious beliefs, and that's when things get missed around children. So what we need services to do is draw a line in the sand. Make sure that our educators understand what, as a service, what we see as specific types of concerns. Would you like to know what the law is around parental discipline? Okay, so in the ACT, every state's different. The ACT is actually the only state that doesn't have it in their criminal code or their crimes act. In the ACT, it's just it's civil law. Basically, what they do is that every incident is applied to the reasonable person's test. So, and that changes all the time. I mean, when I was growing up, my mum was walloping me with wooden spoons and the principal was hitting me with a cane, and the normal person in the community thought, you deserve that, you little hoo-ha. All right? But we know those things have changed, and it's a complex world where we need educators to have the tools to be able to understand that. But that starts with us. If we're the leaders and we're the owners, we need to be able to provide that platform for our educators. So I would suggest, if I was doing something around that, that I would expect that if we saw any mark on a child now from any type of discipline, it's unacceptable. If a child's hit with anything, if it's a thong, a wooden spoon, a belt, anything, it's unacceptable. But if the child's saying or demonstrating they're being hit around the head, it's unacceptable. But if we give staff that baseline, it makes sure that they understand that it's a catalyst for us as a service to know that we've classed that as significant. We always want them talking about minor things, but we also need them to understand when it's become something significant. Does everybody kind of understand that process? It's just like neglect. You know, if we have a child that comes to your service, they've been there for a week. For 1 week, they haven't been bathed. For the same week, they're in the same underpants, shorts, and shirt. Is that neglect? No, it's not. Is there any law in Australia saying that you have to bath? Bathing is a lifestyle choice. Is there any law in Australia saying that you have to wear clean clothes and wash your clothes? It's a lifestyle choice. Remember, we live in a free democracy where everybody's allowed to live the way they want to live. For it to become neglect, the child has to be suffering something. Yes, it can be an indicator, but it's not neglect yet. Until the child has urinary tract infection or other children are calling them smelly and won't play with them, all of those kind of things give us a basis for us to understand what neglect is. Does everybody kind of understand that process? But it's important that we have that process of being able to provide educators that process. All right? Domestic violence and all of those sort of things are extremely complex, and we need to make sure that part of our education and our induction processes to staff is that they actually understand what our baseline is. You know, we already have mandatory reporting in every state that use very descriptive words. They use reasonable suspicion, a child suffering significant harm. If I was to ask you to write down on a piece of paper what those terms mean, you would all write down something different. So we need to provide our educators and our team what that baseline is. Otherwise, we miss things because we're not informed about them, because those decisions are made by them on the ground. Right, so it's really important that we're focusing and understanding how we support staff at the right time. Everybody, it's as simple as, I'll do one more for you. I think I've got time to do one more before I move on to sex. It's like sexual abuse. I mean, if we're rationalizing, we talk about sexualized behavior with young children all the time. I mean, if you've got young Jane who's been enrolled with you for 2 days, and the second day she goes outside for some outside programming and you see her go over to a pole and she starts rubbing her crutch up and down a pole really sexually. Is that sexualized behavior? Who says yes? Who says no? Yeah. Okay. Remember I talked about assumptions? All right. So we need to make sure that we're teaching educators that they're always going to have an assumption. When a child does something in front of you or says something that shocks you, you instantly have an assumption based on your professional subconscious. So we need to teach them and give them the tools to be able to support that. So their tools is getting those educators to understand two really important questions they should always be asking children all the time. Where'd you see that? Where'd you hear that? If educators are using those questions all the time, then they're clarifying. They're not making assumptions. Does everybody understand that? I understand with babies and when children aren't talking, we have to make assumptions. But when they can talk, it's important. Because when that child does that on the pole and we ask her what she's doing, she might tell us she had an itch. She watched Miley Cyrus dance on television. Mum does pole dancing every Wednesday night. Then it gives us a particular process of us to decide what we've just heard, whether we need further clarification or we've got a concern. And it's also about us understanding that Miley Cyrus dancing on television to Wrecking Ball, we all see the sexual connotation. A four-year-old has absolutely no idea what they're looking at. They're just mimicking dancing. All right. And just so we understand around sexualized behavior and how difficult it is for us, even as adults, our perception around things change. I chucked in pole dancing because 15 years ago, if you told me you're pole dancing, I would think of Demi Moore and striptease. But now if you tell me you're pole dancing, I think of gym and exercise first. So it's a complex changing world. So we need to make sure that we're equipping our educators with that changing information all the time as well. So it's important that we're breaking that down for them to understand that. So what we're going to do now is that we've had a look at staff. Now we're going to get you to make sure that you understand families and children about what we're looking for them and how we support them a little bit. So just a few statistics. We know that there's a lot of children and a lot of families that are under stress. So to put that into context for you, Australia has the highest divorce rate than any other westernised country in the world. We have the highest use of ice per capita than any other country in the world. We're the third highest use of cocaine per capita than any other country in the world. We're in the top 10 users of illicit and prescribed drugs per capita. We're in the top 15 users of alcohol. We have one of the highest suicide and mental health rates, and our domestic violence rates are alarming. It's one in every seven homes in Australia now has some sort of domestic violence order attached to it. And when we add that onto the financial strain on families within our communities, we know that a large number of our families, whether however they present themselves to you, are usually under some sort of stress. So it's important that we recognise that and we make sure that we understand what child safe standards are all about when we're implementing them into our services. So the first thing around families is that we need to understand what we talk about contemporary thinking. So contemporary thinking is all about you understanding how am I going to engage with families. And we hear that term early intervention a lot. Early intervention needs to be a process where you can target families without them feeling like you're picking on them. That's the simplest way that I can give that to you. We've already seen that in a lot of situations and, but a lot of the times in some schools that I see now, they've lost that ability to target families. You know, I don't know, but I still see it a lot where, you know, a child will be found in a school with headlights and the way that the school deals with it is they send a blanket message to all families asking them to check their child's hair, look for headlights and treat them. All the families do that except the one family that they actually wanted them to do it. All right, so we need to make sure that we strategize about how we're going to make sure that you stay targeted with your families. To do that, you need to create a helping hands bank with all your families. You need to understand how they like to be engaged with. We need to have blended communication strategies. Some families don't use apps. Some parents don't look at their phones. How do we communicate with them? How do we know how they like to be communicated with? Just remember that outside pressures influence the way parents deal with their children's behaviour. All right, so if you know that grandparents are picking up their child at your service 3 days a week, they have huge influence on parenting. I mean, the reality is that how often have you said something where you sounded exactly like your mum or your dad as soon as you said it? Intergenerational patterns play a huge part in everything that we do in our lives, and parenting is one of them. So it's really important that we understand who we're dealing with and we create that individual package for each family. And if we're doing that, then you're able to have those early intervention processes. One of the biggest things I ask services to do is that I know we're really time poor within your industries, but whenever you have a family or a parent that's willing to talk to you at that time, please try and refrain from them going, here's a list of services, please give them a call when you get home and you'll get some support. The reality is, how many of those people actually ring any of those numbers? It'd be just like us. At the time, we're vulnerable, and then we get that thought, oh, I can't do that, I don't need that, other people need it more, all of those sort of things. When they're vulnerable with you and they're talking to you at the service, for us to have the ability to take them into the office and help them make that call and let them have that first conversation, it just means from your service perspective, we know that the family's actually getting help, which might mean that all the problems that they're causing at our service may minimize, so we're not as stressed. All right. But a lot of the times those families are just like, they have these big cycles. They're great, but when something goes wrong in a household, everything happens where you're dealing with it. And so if we're supporting them a little bit better and having those early intervention strategies, hopefully that takes that away a little bit. Now, when we talk about children, it's really important that we understand that children do not have fight, fright, and flight processes. Children of young age have survival mode. Now, we need you to understand about young children is that we know that 95% of children now aged under 12 years of age in Australia spend more time awake with somebody else than their own parents. The reality is with early childhood, before and after school care, and schools, children are in those environments more than what they're awake with their parents from Monday to Friday. In fact, early childhood figures is something like 4 hours they're awake with their parents a day, less than that. And when you think about one of those hours is the hour in the morning, all right, children, whilst we're really bound by making sure that we're working with families to try and find that similarity around how we provide our environment to the way they have it at home, especially in our nurseries and all of those sort of things, children are being exposed to things at home that simply that doesn't happen with us. And so it's not normal for them because your environment's normal. So it's important that we understand that. Now, trauma-based behaviour, one of the big processes around our child safe standards is ensuring that we understand that children will come to us with trauma-based behaviours. It's ensuring that we have a child safe environment where they don't switch back into that. But the problem is a lot of children, when they arrive with you, don't make that switch to you. So what we mean by that is that we want them to switch from survival mode into cognitive emotional mode. If they're in that, then their ability to engage with you and they feel safe. But if they're in that survival mode, they don't have that. Now, majority of children, you think about that. I mean, for all of you that are parents, how's that normal hour in the morning before you get to school drop off or early childhood? It's wonderful, isn't it? All right. But it's important that we understand that children are definitely in survival mode when they pull up in your car park every single morning. They've been pulled from pillar to post. There's been arguments most of the time. People are running. They're getting, you know, hurried, all of those sort of things. Most children, when they walk into your service, it's almost like they walk in and go, oh, I'm here. All right. But there are some children that don't display that. They're usually the children that are clingy. They'll only go to one particular educator each day. They hit the ground running and it takes you a while to bring them back to you. And a lot of the time, that circle of children are the ones that will flick in and out of that trauma-based behavior all the time. The other thing that we need to be understanding is that when parents sign that iPad at the front of your service, that child becomes your responsibility. We have policies in place where we expect parents to bring children to you. But it's about every center I go to, I'm always told that, we didn't even know the child's there. That parent always just pushes the child through the door and they're out before they even say something to somebody. Well, then as a service, we need to have a risk management operational process to support that. So what I'm going to show you is how you have a child safe process that allows you to have that with parents where we're just making parents create an activity where there's a proper handover. The other thing that it supports is obviously our active supervision and our guiding children's behaviour principles. I challenge anybody here who can tell me that they have an individual guiding children's behaviour principle for a child each day if you do not know each day how that child slept the night before and whether they ate their breakfast. Those two things will tell you about a child's behaviour with you each day. And if you don't know those things, you're making assumptions of the child based on what you know about the child, not where they're at that day. So this model is not new. It's been used everywhere and usually in schools. How often on your social media have you seen where you see teachers outside a classroom, they have a special handshake with children when they walk in, they do a dance with them, or the children pick how they say good morning to their educators? It's really, really important that you understand that that works really, really well in early childhood for that transitioning of young children. If you have an A-frame blackboard where just think of wiggles and all the different movements that they do, put three up each morning. When a child walks in, they pick how they say good morning to you. They pick how they say goodbye to their parents. That gives you the opportunity to say to mum or dad, how did they sleep last night? Did they eat their breakfast? All right. You'll have some parents who are always in a hurry. They'll come in. They know your answer. You're going to ask it, and they give you the answer before you even have to ask. But we've created a habit with parents. All right. And that habit's through safe transitioning of their child. All right. And if a child and if a parent does the wrong thing now where they just push a child through the door and that child follows the parents out into the car park and you go under investigation, then you can clearly show that you put in a risk management strategy to prevent parents from doing that. That parent did the wrong thing. It wasn't about that you allowed that child to freely roam through the center. That's how we create those child safe environments. Does everybody kind of get those ideas and processes? So that's what that's all about. And using transitioning is really, really important tool in everything that we do. Active supervision. There's no, when I go to a service, a lot of the times I'll see a child that's on the fort and they want to go over to the sandpit, they'll just all of a sudden just run across there. They're 3 or 4 years of age. There's an educator at the fort actively supervising. There's an educator at the sandpit actively supervising. Is it so wrong that we're teaching children to transition, that they have to go to the educator at the sandpit? I'm just going, I want to, at the sport, I want to go at the sandpit. And they high-five the educator and they run over to the sandpit. That gives educators an opportunity to ask that child when they come to the sandpit, where'd you come from, mate? Oh, from the fort. And then that gives the educator that opportunity to tell them where what the activity is going on in the sandpit. Because a lot of the times we see that child come into the sandpit and explosions happen and put children in unsafe positions. All right. If we're having a transitioning, it gives us the opportunity to do that. It gives the educator in the sandpit time to look at the educator over at the fort, and the educator at the fort goes, well, that means good luck. All right. Or if they go like this, it means they're having a good day. All right, but at least we've got communication and we have safe, we're creating safe environments, safe transitioning, and we're communicating with each other. So it's all about us just strategizing and thinking how we do things. The other thing by having stuff like that, just remember that we know 1 in every 7 of your families at your service have been exposed to domestic violence. As what I see in most centers is that when children are loud, educators are louder. As soon as 1 in every 7 children in your service hear your voice get loud, you flick them back into survival mode. And then they don't follow direction, they won't engage with you, and then you become frustrated. Now, we just need to make sure that you strategize about how we're getting children's attention without using our voices. You know, we're seeing it in schools for a long time now. They use clapping, they use triangles, they use stop, look, and listen, 1, 2, 3, eyes on me. They allow children to self-regulate and engage with that. But it's important that we're doing that. Okay. Children's rights. I guess a couple of things. Obviously, children's rights is really important. And I'm not going to go through all the stuff that ASIC was sent out because I'm sure that you've all read it. And we know that we've got educators checking in with children before we do something around children. But it's also important that children's rights is also about them developing their own self-mechanisms to protect themselves. And one of the biggest things that we need to understand about our environment and what's happening within our sector is basically that we need them to understand that sometimes they need to ask before they do things. The reality is that the sector in early childhood is changing. We definitely have educators now that don't like hugging, do not like children sitting on their laps, all right, or would like to get themselves in a position before that happens. The only way that's going to happen, if we're teaching young children, can I have a hug? Can I sit on your lap? All right. That's part of a child having that development. And we're always talking about the risk around grooming behavior by somebody that we work with. By us having strategies around that where we're seeing children asked to do something, and we have those processes in place within our service where we're educating children, when somebody does something that steps outside those realms, it's a lot easier us to start asking questions about their behavior as educators. All right, but if we're just freely letting people do whatever they want to do around children, we need to make sure that we have some boundaries around that. I'm not asking for people not to express themselves in the way that they feel comfortable in doing, but we just also need to understand that children only need to understand individuals do things differently. All right, so it's important that we're strategizing around those children's rights as well. When we talk about child safe standards, the whole idea about them is us about identifying things that our family is struggling with, what's happening in our communities, and what's happening with our staff. And hopefully I gave you some ideas and hints about how we can do that and how we strategize around how we make sure that we're protecting children the right way and making sure that we're building staff's capacity to be able to respond and to support families. So the footprint, I see a lot of services when we talk about the child safe standards and we talk about having a commitment to child protection and child safety at their front. And a lot of them have big paragraph blurbs and all of those sort of things. If you take that to a staff member, if you've honestly hung that up, I want you to take it to your educators, each individual one, and ask them what it means to them. Okay, because we want them to be able to highlight those things. They have to have courage to be able to have a voice as an educator. They have to be able to speak up when they have a concern and feel like that they're being supported when they do that. There needs to be team support, so we're all on the same page about how we're responding to things. We have a trusted process, so that means communicating with our managers, so our managers and our supervisors are providing the support that you need to make a decision about how you're going to handle things. And just remember that when we talk around mandatory reporting does not move from the educator that had the concern to your manager. It never does. It always remains with the educator that raised the concern. Our manager's there to support us in making decisions, and they can report it on our behalf. But it's our job as the educator to make sure that our educators are checking in with management to make sure that they're happy with what was done with their concern. So it's really important that we understand that. And safety and a child's smile should be something that we mandate at our service. It should be a gift. And we do that by having staff that want to be working where they are and feeling like they're being supported around those very difficult stuff around families and what families bring to the table and what children bring to the table and they have to deal with.
Thank you so much, Michael. Really insightful and great to hear those. Really practical. And I think transitional steps to building culture. I mean, that's really what it's about. Your presentation reminded me there's two other pieces of work that we do have on our website from symposiums. So we have the trauma-informed training, which is affordable training for a trauma-informed practice, which was developed by colleagues in Victoria in conjunction with the ACT government. That have a look at our website, you'll get a link to that. That is a really great world-class piece of training. I'd also like to remind, and we might, when we do the link for this symposium, we might resend the link to sexualized harmful behaviors symposium work we did as part of the risk assessment and risk management two-day workshop, which we did hear from some incredible experts from health. I think that was 22. Yeah, far out. Feels like the other day. So we'll send those links because that really ties into what Mike was talking about. I would like to hand over to our last guest speaker, Amy Duncan, who's the Sector Engagement Senior Officer, Narraganawali Reconciliation Australia. Amy's an experienced early childhood teacher and has worked in a variety of ACT ECEC settings and organisations, including Early Child Australia Today, Amy's going to explore the concept and context of reconciliation in Australia, the significant role of the education sector in driving a stronger future of reconciliation across the nation and what that means for the ECEC sector. And Amy will share the current Ngarrindjeri resources that highlight how building relationships, respect and opportunities within the ECEC sector can be meaningfully complemented by reconciliation action plans. Amy's been incredibly generous with her time with us over the years, and so we're really grateful to have Amy back today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for having me here, and it's nice to see so many familiar faces in the room. So I would just like to start by acknowledging the fact that we're all gathering here today on Ngunnawal country. Oh, I can see your screen up. Oh, sorry. Okay. Pay my respects to elders past, present and future. I would also like to acknowledge the fact that we're all gathering and meeting on land that has never been ceded, and that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders and communities have continued to fight for the rights for this to happen. I would also like to acknowledge any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are also joining us in the room here today. When it comes to reconciliation in and across Australia, it's really important to reflect on where we've come from and where we're going, and how we're going to all continue to work towards and drive reconciliation in and across everything that we do and across education. So my name is Amy Duncan. I've been working working in and across the early childhood education and care space in the ACT. I'm a non-Indigenous woman who works, I'm very privileged to work at Reconciliation Australia and work with a team of people of First Nations and non-First Nations people in the Ngarrindjeri Reconciliation in Education team. Just to echo what has already kind of been said across all of the presentations, and this is something that's kind of been already discussed and talked about, but cultural safety is an aspect of the safety that's kind of already been discussed and talked about. And SNAKE released this report in keeping kids safe in cultural safety and national principles of child safe organisations, which is another really nice document if you're not already aware of it. I would encourage you to access it, but it does kind of talk about the importance and echo some of the updates that have been made in the national frameworks, particularly around what cultural awareness and cultural sensitivity means. And the other piece that I think is really important to mention is that NIAC recently released a school exclusion report, which I can send to you in the links that you can share with everybody. And as Michael was talking, it's really a truth-telling piece, and even though it does specifically kind of refer to and use data around school exclusions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, it does refer to education institutions. And it starts off by saying that schools and other education settings should be places of healing rather than places of trauma and exclusion. This is a fundamentally different view of education in the 21st century that Indigenous peoples held hundreds of years ago. And it's equally and fundamentally different philosophical understanding of the purpose of education from standard mainstream views of education. And I think that drawing on that, it's vital that we think about this in terms of when we start thinking about our place in the space of where we've come from in reconciliation, but also in the education sector and where we want to go. So
Narraganawali is part of Reconciliation Australia. It's a program part of Reconciliation Australia. We have several programs that exist, one of which is the National Reconciliation Action Plans, which are developed for organisations. So organisations such as the CEQA have a Reconciliation Action Plan. So they're just to support everybody to understand that there's a difference between a Reconciliation Action Plan that's developed through the Narraganawali platform, which is specifically designed to support schools and early learning services. And then there are Reconciliation Action Plans that are developed for organisations. My role is to support education and training partners who have Reconciliation Action Plans to think about how the Narraganawali platform can be used to support the work that you do in and across the sector, as well as thinking about how to best support early learning services that you might be overseeing or working with, or schools to engage meaningfully in reconciliation initiatives. We also have our community truth-telling program, Indigenous government program, and then Reconciliation Week, which is now more than ever, to run from the 27th of May to the 3rd of June. Oops. Okay, so Narraganawali means alive, well-being, coming together and peace, and it was gifted to us from the United Ngunnawal Elders Council. And the program was launched in 2015. And I've put some impact statements up the back, but you can also find them on our website. Reconciliation Australia's Narraganawali program supports schools and early learning services to take action towards reconciliation. It fosters intergenerational change in classrooms, education institutions, and communities. We have 150,000 individuals engaged with our platform. About 40% of all schools and early learning services in Australia have a Narraganawali plan, action plan, or have registered to develop one. And then we have about 2,000. I think it's actually closer to 3,000 now. Early learning services and schools develop a RAP. The Reconciliation Action Plans are I think it needs to be clear that they are a tool for supporting engaging in reconciliation. And how that's done is that they, through that development process, offer professional learning curriculum resources and through our national awards. I'm going to skip over this one just for the sake of time. So one of the other things that Reconciliation Australia does is we produce State of Reconciliation reports. This will be coming up to be released by the end of this year, if not the beginning of next year. One of the kind of really key things that the report produced in 2021 is the five dimensions of reconciliation, and this was what was agreed for and what was found to be the five most significant areas for reconciliation to become possible. And all of these five dimensions are all interrelated and all need to happen at the same time in order for reconciliation to be achieved. As you can see up here, includes race relations, equity and equality, unity, institutional integrity and historical acceptance. Reconciliation means different things to different people. And I think very similarly, it is definitely draws off our unconscious bias around what we know and what we have learned about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and peoples, and our own education. Everyone here has been through the education system, and I know for myself, I wasn't informed about the true histories of Australia through my own education system. So that means that as we are now, we're working towards teaching the next generation of children about what it means to engage in truth-telling. In order for that to happen, we have to constantly reevaluate what our unconscious biases are and what reconciliation means to us, which is an ongoing journey. This comic was Sorry, the writing's really small, so I will read a bit to you. This comic was produced in 1997, and it is a very small snapshot of what people understood reconciliation to be at the time. So, for example, isn't reconciliation supposed to happen when you've had a fight and you make up? We can't change what's happened in the past. We can only make a better future by understanding the past. Only when we have equality we can have reconciliation. Otherwise, it's just another BS word. So I'd like you to take a moment and think about what your position is in the reconciliation movement. So you can write this down on a piece of paper or paper with you. You'll get a chance to revisit these slides. This activity is also one that's on our platform as a professional learning activity, so it is one that you can do with your teams as well. In order to engage in learning, unlearning and relearning about reconciliation, we need to understand our own position and what reconciliation means to us personally and professionally. So what do we think about reconciliation? What does it mean to me? What's your own cultural identity? What's important for you to understand, and what does it mean for you professionally? And how do you feel about reconciliation? How is this part of your story? What's your position in terms of the collective effort? And what are your personal relationships with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and how does that affect how you feel about reconciliation? So historically, the formal education system in Australia has served as a tool of colonisation. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' pedagogies and perspectives have been systematically excluded from and silenced within the mainstream education institutions, policies and frameworks. As a result, generations of Australians have grown up with inadequate understanding of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander histories and cultures, with a very limited awareness of the true history of Australia. Education institutions have contributed to this through a lack of historical acceptance and deepening the inequalities, injustices, and disrupting the pathways towards relationship building and unification process across generations. I think what Michael was saying before in creating safe places for families and children and educators is really critical to this, because it's how we act now is going to have an impact on how we start to undo the way that institutions have and continue to respond to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I think trauma-informed practice is a really key aspect of that, because when you have a grandparent, for example, who's coming in and is the primary carer of their grandchild and has had the experience where if they got sent to school, they would be taken away from their family, that's something that we need to be really deeply aware of, and we need to understand and be able to know how to respond to if there is an incident that happens with their grandchild at school. How are you going to approach that situation, and how are you going to, what understanding do you have of the history of the institution that you work in and the impact that that continues to have on families and children? So there's been some reports such as the importance of reconciliation in education. Again, I will provide you with some links for the sake of time. So we've come a long way in our nation's reconciliation and education journey, but we still have a long way to go. So just very quietly amongst your small tables, I'm going to give you about a minute and a half to share with the person next to you what you think some of the next most important steps are in the reconciliation education journey. Okay, so thank you very much for taking the opportunity to share. I need some clapping sticks or a bell. So professional requirements and opportunities. We've already heard this mentioned a little bit before, and I think it's really important to continue to think about the professional standards for teachers, particularly in areas focused area 1.4 and 2.4. We have the EYLF My Time, Our Place framework, which was really exciting for us to see the updates that were made, including the new principle, which is has been included, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives. We know from the sector and the way that the amount of early childhood educators and services that register to develop a RAP and go on to develop a RAP, the early childhood sector is really highly engaged with the Narragansett Wally program. So we know that this is something that is already being discussed and thought about and thoughtfully implemented through practice, and it's really nice to kind of see the updates that have been made. So thank you very much, and all of the people that have contributed to the hard work that's gone into making sure that this is also reflected in the new guiding documents that we all use, including the vision that has been included, which acknowledges that all children need to be informed and active informed members about their communities with knowledge of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives. I also just want to very quickly highlight the fact that it is perspectives with a plural, because we know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives are diverse, and that every Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person has their own individual perspective based on their own lived life experience. And part of the way that we can support Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander self-determination is by taking on board the diverse perspectives that exist for every individual family member, educator, child, because even the children of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families are going to have their own perspectives and have their own understandings of what culture means to them. So the National Quality Standard, particularly Quality Area 6, that supports engaging with reconciliation in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families through collaborative partnerships with families and communities. And then, of course, the Australian Curriculum, which I think it's important to think about the professional standards for teachers and the Australian Curriculum, even in the context of early childhood education and care, because children's education journey and families' education journey is ongoing. It doesn't stop the moment they leave your services, and hopefully we can kind of continue to build our community practice that involves schools and early learning services working together to engage in reconciliation. And version 9 of the early Australian curriculum has some really, really great examples of truth telling, for example, specifically mentioning massacres and things like that. And so it's really our jobs to think about how we can thoughtfully and respectfully support children to engage in truth-telling practices that are in ways that are developmentally appropriate, that are also going to set them up for success when they go through school, and they can start thinking about, you know, forming their own opinion and perspectives based on ways that they've been informed to critically analyse and understand where we have come from and where we would like to go. So education and wellbeing is a whole systems approach. I think we've heard quite a lot about that again today. There is also a really lovely BU resource that talks about specifically the how reconciliation and wellbeing are so interconnected with each other. One of the government policies that informs this work is the Mumbwate Education Declaration. This is a really underutilised document. I think it's what informs government policy for making decisions around reconciliation and education and informing educational practices around ensuring that it sits firmly within the education system and at an institution level. And I would encourage everyone to take time to read it. This quote is talking about the Australian government's commitment to, but it also does have really specific references to early childhood education and care and the role that we play and the sector plays in informing and including reconciliation in education practices. Okay, so again, going to give you just a moment to have a think about what policies and frameworks and tools that you're and resources that you're currently using to support your schools or early learning services reconciliation journey, and how effectual, like how much, I've lost my words, how effective are they?